the high desert in the great American Southwest. I bid you all good evening, good morning, good afternoon, whatever of the 25 time zones you may lurk in on this earth, all of them covered one way or the other by this very spiffy show called Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell, honored to be here with you for the weekend, and distressed to be having to talk about the death of former President Ronald Reagan at 93 years of age. Ronald Reagan, the cheerful crusader, and he was cheerful, wasn't he? Who devoted his presidency to winning the Cold War, trying to scale back government, and making people believe it was morning in America again, died Saturday after, as you know, a long struggle with Alzheimer's disease. Nancy Reagan said, quote, "My family and I would like the world to know that President Ronald Reagan has passed away after 10 years of Alzheimer's disease at 93 years of age. We appreciate everyone's prayers." From everywhere, of course, across the planet, eulogies are streaming in. And it was a really sad day. Just a really sad day. I was a really big booster of President Reagan's, and a lot of people might not know that who had listened to me in recent years, but in the 80s, I was doing, at least that part of the 80s, very much a political talk show, and I defended Ronald Reagan very hard. Earlier, I'm very good friends with his son, Michael. I spoke to Michael earlier today, briefly. And Michael and I actually talk every couple of weeks. And it was a big blow. But, of course, there was a lot of time when President Reagan had, in a way, he left us today, but he really left us some time ago with Alzheimer's. Nancy Reagan is an ardent supporter, of course, of stem cell research that would have done something, perhaps, for President Reagan, and it is a point of disagreement between Nancy and the current administration, as you know. Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that on the night President Reagan would die, you know, he was a very special man. He, you know, they called him the great communicator. He did something for America. I don't know. He comforted America. He was a very special man. And so it's interesting on that night that I have here tonight a presidential candidate. After the Reagan years, very shortly thereafter, I switched parties and I became a libertarian. And the reason I did that is because I watched candidates campaign, listened to them campaign, and there are extremely sharp differences between Republicans and Democrats when they campaign. I mean, they actually spout this, you know, to the party pure. And then when they get in office, what I noticed after President Reagan was that they didn't govern the way they campaigned. And that's when I became a libertarian, when I began to see not a lot of difference in the way they actually governed. Well, tonight, we're going to talk to Michael Bednarik. Michael went to Indiana University in Bloomington. This is a very interesting story. He began his career as a computer programmer at nuclear power plants in Illinois. Bednarik moved to California, was granted a security clearance to work on the stealth bomber simulator. That's an interesting background. Following changes to California gun laws, Bednarik moved to Texas, where he worked as a senior trainer for Evolutionary Technologies International for 4 years. So he's a techie background. He's volunteered with the Red Cross, has worked as a scoutmaster, enjoys scuba diving and parachuting, is a qualified tandem master and an accelerated free fall instructor. Wow. He essentially came out of nowhere to win the Libertarian nomination. What a surprise. He was not considered one of the two top front runners. Hollywood producer Aaron Russo and radio talk show host Gary Nolan, in fact, were. However, Michael must have done something to make quite an impression on the delegates at the convention, as the voting count in the runoff between he and Russo was very close, but he won. And here he is tonight, the Libertarian candidate for the presidency of the United States, Michael Bednarik. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
And as you know, earlier today I called you with the news of President Reagan's death, and you said, well, should we reschedule? And, you know, I thought about it, and I thought, you know, no. Here comes a man who's running for president, for the presidency himself. Maybe it would be most appropriate, really, to have you on. And perhaps you'd like to say something about the passing of President Reagan.
Well, he was one of the presidents that I was honored to vote for. And he was probably the most libertarian president that we've had in the last 75 years.
Hear, hear.
He ran on the Republican ticket, obviously, but he followed and worked towards making the government smaller. His principles were very libertarian, and you know, I think that people would vote for that type of a government again, and that's what the Libertarian Party is offering the voters this November.
Well, let me ask you about how you did it. I mean, essentially, you did come from nowhere. I mean, you know, usually by the time you get to the convention, it's pretty well known what's going to happen, or if not, pretty close. And number one and number two, and there you were, I guess, what, number three, and now you're, how'd that happen?
Well, I started out at the suggestion of many of my friends in Austin. I had been teaching an 8-hour class on the Constitution for about 3 years, and they felt that I had an ability to explain our libertarian message to non-libertarians in a manner that would make them understand it and have it appeal to them. And they felt that if I was running for a national office, that would give me an opportunity to spread our message a little bit further than just Austin, Texas. And so I was happy to pursue that, to try to bring new members into the Libertarian Party, knowing that the people that I spoke to would vote for whoever the delegates nominated in Atlanta. I was certainly not anticipating that it would be me. But we did a lot of hard work, and every state convention that we went to, I diligently talked to the state delegates, expressed my my platform, which is very similar among libertarian candidates, and tried to establish relationships with people so that I would be more than just a passing candidate.
Well, you must have found a way to connect with the true believers.
Well, again, I adhere very strictly to the libertarian principle. I'm unwilling to compromise when it comes to the Bill of Rights and people's individual rights. And apparently, my performance in the debate on Saturday night seemed to really turn the tide.
Huh. Maybe, perhaps then you can explain. I have some friends that are ardent conservative Republicans. And they frequently say to me, explain the difference between libertarianism and conservative philosophy. I mean, define the difference. Where is the difference? Because the two many times seem very close.
Well, in many cases, we are close. We, the Libertarian Party, holds similarities to both the Republicans and Democrats. We are similar to Republicans in that they profess to want a smaller government, and they are fiscally conservative. They want people to retain control of their own money and their own investments.
Mm-hmm.
Where we differ is in social rights, and this is where we fall more in line with the Democrats, who are socially liberal, who feel that people ought to be allowed to do whatever they want with their life as long as they are not hurting someone else. And so libertarians basically take the best from both parties and try to offer that to, back to the people.
Did you hear what I said at the beginning of the program about why I became a libertarian? Because I began not to see a difference between the way presidents would govern and people
right.
in office would govern. Running, that's one thing, but then achieving office and actually doing it, something else again.
That's true. And one thing that libertarians have never done is raised people's taxes. We have an economic problem in the United States right now. Many people are out of work. The people who are working are concerned about being out of work. The free trade agreements that our government has established is causing an economic environment which sends jobs out of the country, making it less likely that they will return.
Well, Michael, I just heard earlier today it's just 5.something% unemployment. You mean that's not an accurate number?
I don't know. I haven't been able to keep tabs on exactly what the unemployment rates are. But if we switch technologies, people may be unemployed for a short period of time and then move into a new field as they mm-hmm. develop skills. But if we create an environment of regulations which make it more and more expensive for companies to perform their manufacturing or do their assembling here in the United States, they are likely to move their manufacturing offshore. And once they've moved the production offshore, it's going to be much harder to bring it back. And when people are unemployed because of the shift in jobs out of the country, there are no new jobs. There are less jobs in the United States that they can switch to.
Well, I was being a little facetious because I was trying to suggest that perhaps the numbers are cooked a little bit. In other words, people who have given up looking for work, for example, are taken off the count of how many are really unemployed.
Well, so, I understand.
So it's probably many more. We should examine some things that libertarians stand for. And why not start with maybe the roughest, or maybe it isn't the roughest, I don't know, but the war in Iraq.
Well, fundamentally, the war in Iraq is unconstitutional. Congress has a responsibility to declare that war, and basically they pass that information off to the president. However, this particular instance started when on September 11th, when our World Trade Center was destroyed, and it was touted that Osama bin Laden was the culprit, and we originally started searching for him. And then somewhere along the line, we switched from Osama bin Laden to Saddam Hussein. And I never really understood a clear change. I don't know how we went from Afghanistan to Iraq.
I never got that either, and I still don't, Michael. I still don't. So, if you were to become president, you would get the United States. You know, that's an interesting question in itself. I mean, we are now there and extremely committed. So, realistically, if you were to walk into the White House, what could you do?
Well, what I could do is give my military leaders the instructions to bring our troops home as quickly and safely as possible. I understand that when you're removing your troops from the field, that gives the enemy an opportunity to attack. And we have lost far too many American lives already. So bringing them home quickly is important, but not nearly as important as bringing them home safely with as few additional fatalities as possible.
What do you see as our current strategy in Iraq to turn it into a democracy?
Well, first of all, the United States is not a democracy. We are a constitutional republic.
Right.
The founding fathers didn't like a democracy, considering it a tyranny of the majority. And the Constitution does not give us the responsibility of establishing democracies around the world. It only gives us the responsibility of protecting American citizens.
It does seem to say just that, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yes. And the Constitution is actually very clear. It is written in simple terms, and most people who read it in my class are usually shocked to discover what the government is actually allowed to do. I will direct them to a particular clause, and they'll read that, and then in some disbelief, look at me and say, well, Congress can't do that. And the beautiful thing is that they've figured this all out by themselves, not something that I've, you know, instilled in them.
Oh, yes. Okay, because of time, we're going to have to move through some things, but we may come back to some of them. The right to keep and bear arms, I'm a gigantic supporter of the Second Amendment, a big supporter of the Second Amendment, and it's going in mixed ways in the United States right now. In some areas of the U.S., you can't own a gun.
Right.
You go to jail. Own a gun, go to jail. Other areas of the United States, you can get a license to carry a concealed weapon. So where do libertarians stand on in this field?
Well, first of all, people need to understand the difference between rights and privileges. A right is something that you can do without asking. A privilege is something which a person or entity of higher authority allows you to do,
mm-hmm.
and that makes rights and privileges opposites based on whether or not you have to get permission. Nobody in the United States currently has to get a government permit in order to go to church because freedom of religion is protected by the First Amendment.
Quite right.
The Second Amendment works the same way. I mean, people may not like the fact that I carry a gun. It may make them nervous. They may go home and toss and turn at night. But my rights are not predicated on whether someone else feels comfortable with it. And so my position is that 20,000 gun laws in the United States are unconstitutional because they violate a person's right to protect their life and property.
Oddly, of course, our president, Reagan, wasn't carrying a gun when he got shot, and oddly, it resulted in new laws to, you know, ban guns. And
right.
Control guns. And so the Libertarian Party then is very much purely behind the right to bear arms, period. It is what it says it is, the right.
That's correct. And I would like to point out that, you know, if a half a dozen passengers on the airplanes were allowed to exercise their Second Amendment rights, the terrorists on September 11th would never have gotten past the beverage cart.
As president, how would you have handled the situation at 9/11?
Well, assuming that 9/11 still happened, one of the things that we need to do is to give demonstrable proof of who did the actions.
Mm-hmm.
I'm fairly certain that we should have been able to collect evidence, and if Osama bin Laden was the perpetrator, we would be able to show Congress and the American people the proof. In fact, the people of Afghanistan were willing to offer him up if we could only, you know, show some conclusive proof that he was involved and that he was at fault. Internationally, we need to operate law the same way, and, you know, you are innocent until proven guilty.
It's interesting. You said, I caught you saying, assuming it had still happened, had there been some sort of libertarian presidency for some time, you think there's a chance it would not have happened? It was obvious intelligence failure, they're saying.
Well, that's true, but the environment, what we have American troops in over 130 countries around the world. We've got our troops stationed there. We are influencing other countries, the governments of other countries. We're influencing their economies. And politically, we are poking them in the eye with a sharp stick. And then we seem to be surprised when these other countries are unhappy with our foreign policy. The Iraqi people want to be sovereign. They want basically the same thing that all Americans want. They just want to be left alone to live their lives and operate their governments without interference. And the Iraqis want to operate their government without U.S. or U.N. interference. And I think that if we followed George Washington's advice and established economic ties with all countries and had entangling alliances with none, then there would be less reason for other countries to hate us. We wouldn't be there interfering, and if we had strong economic ties, we would be providing them with goods and services that raise their standard of living and improve their lifestyle, and it's very unlikely that they're going to bite the hand that feeds them. So if we are trading with them and helping them, we become their friends, and I think that would be that would go a long way towards world peace.
Was there sufficient cause to go to Iraq in the first place? I mean, was there? Did we have enough cause to go in? No weapons of mass destruction to speak of yet, and I guess all that's left is the tyranny that was going on in Iraq. Certainly he was a brutal leader who did have rape rooms, did torture people, was a bad guy.
There is no doubt. I mean, libertarians understand that Saddam Hussein was an evil person, and we, you know, the world is, you know, certainly better off without him. But the reason that we were given for going into Iraq was the weapons of mass destruction and a sense of imminent threat that if we don't do this right now, then, you know, eventually the United States will be attacked and, you know, we're going to have this, you know, dramatic loss of life. And I don't think that history has played that out, and I don't believe that we were under the significant threat that we were told we were.
So do you think we stand any chance of just, you know, turning them into a significant republic, a relatively free country, when the last boot leaves Iraq land?
I don't know that it is possible to do that. The 13th Amendment was passed in, I believe it was 1865, establishing that there was no slavery. Well, ideally, you know, as soon as that amendment was passed, you know, blacks and whites would be treated the same and we would all respect each other. Clearly, history shows that was not the case. You know, easily for another 100 years, there was racial tension, and still today, there are some evidence of that. And so looking at our own history, it's clear that you're not going to be able to change public opinion overnight simply by passing a law. It's ridiculous for Americans to assume that we can just waltz into Iraq and write up some, you know, wonderful constitution, and that, you know, the Iraqi people are just going to adhere to all these rules, that all of their personal biases and you know, emotions are just going to change just because the wonderful Americans are there. I don't think that's practical, and it's also not one of the powers that we have delegated to Congress.
So you would then tell our generals to begin getting us out as safely as possible, but out.
But out, yes. If my military leaders suggested that it would take more than 6 months, I would call them into my Oval Office and have them explain precisely why it was taking that long.
All right. Hold on. Michael Bednarik is my guest. He's the Libertarian Party's candidate for the presidency of the United States. Good evening from the high desert in the middle of a soft desert night where I am. This is Coast to Coast AM.
To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM. With Art Bell.
I'm honored to be speaking with the Libertarian Party's candidate for the presidency of the United States, Michael Bednarik. I'm Art Bell. And so far, it sounds a lot like a Republican. Pretty much like a Republican, doesn't he? But we're about to show you where the differences are, and there are major differences indeed. In the next half hour, Maurice Cottrell, who wrote a book called Terracotta Warriors, The Terracotta Warriors, and he'll explain, among other things, why we live, why we have to die, small little questions like that. We'll be back in just a moment. If you'll just stay right where you are, much more to come. We made it through that one, so we owe the world a break. Once again, here is Michael Bednarik. Michael, welcome back. Here's where we're going to probably take a turn away from what sounds quite Republican. Talk a little bit about drugs, for example. We've had now for years and years a gigantic war going on drugs, and one might add, if you believe as we do, the Constitution along with it. What would you do about drugs?
Well, there are a lot of things about the Libertarian Party that I'd like to talk about, and undoubtedly I won't have the time. So before I go into the drugs, I'd like to point people to our website.
Oh, sure.
Which is www.lp.org.
LP as in Libertarian Party.
Libertarianparty.org.
Right. Okay.
And they can also call 1-800-682-1776. And we would be happy to send them some more information about the Libertarian Party.
Give the number again. It's a good number by 1776.
Well, yeah, 1-800-682-1776.
Okay. All right. Drugs.
Drugs. Libertarians have a bad rap. Everybody supposes that we want to just have drugs rampant in the street and that we really don't care that our children are taking drugs. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. Libertarians love their children at least as much as the Republicans and Democrats, and we want to reduce the amount of drugs that our children take in this country. However, we realize that children take drugs because people sell them.
Mm-hmm.
People sell them because drugs are extremely profitable, and drugs are extremely profitable only because they are illegal, just like alcohol during the Prohibition. If we decriminalize drugs, the price will plummet precipitously. Basically, the price will come down. And when the price does come down, then there won't be a profit motive for people to bring drugs to this country. And if there's no people bringing the drugs to this country, then there will be fewer drugs for our children to take. Libertarians do not promise a utopian society where there are no drugs. Ultimately, there will always be, some available, and people will take them. But we think that by decriminalizing them, it will dramatically reduce the amount of drugs that are available for our children to take.
Can you cite any example in the real world where that's happened, Michael? I too have come around to the point where it's not winnable, and so in a way you might as well toss it out, but what would happen when you did? I don't know. I'm not so sure about that. It's a market-driven thing. People want drugs.
Well, in many cases, they start off wanting them, and if they get addicted to them, they have a problem. If they go to the hospitals to get treatment, then they are very likely to be incarcerated because they have this addiction.
Right.
So Another method for reducing the problem would be to decriminalize them so that people who have the problem would be less apprehensive about coming to get treatment for it. They may notice that they're addicted and they, you know, can get off of the drugs a lot sooner. So, you know, there are many cases where, you know, people just are afraid of being arrested and so they remain addicted.
True enough. Another hot button issue, and it's one that I recently examined myself, and that's gay marriage. You know, it's really been all over the headlines, gay marriage. And I was at one time extremely against the idea of gay marriage. But, you know, I had a talk with myself, and I started to ask myself who actually would be hurt by it. And that's the way I asked myself the question, Michael, and it came out, well, you know, I don't really see that anybody would be hurt by it, and maybe they deserve the same kind of things in life that other married people have. And I said, well, maybe I don't have a problem with it. So that was a big surprise for me.
It's important to examine where the first marriage licenses came from. Thomas Jefferson didn't have one. George Washington didn't have one. And, you know, people at that point in time would simply declare their union to the community, and they weren't asking for permission. You know, they would just set up a cabin and begin raising a family.
Sure.
The very first marriage licenses were instituted just prior to the Civil War, where white people had rights and black people only had privileges. If a black person wanted to marry a white person, the black person would have to get permission from the government. Marriage licenses started out as kind of a prevention of interracial marriages.
God, I didn't know that was true.
And
holy mackerel.
Yeah. So, I mean, at one point in time, you know, the idea of having an interracial marriage was just absolutely anathema. And today, we have, people getting married of, you know, various nationalities and races. And it doesn't cause more than even a raised eyebrow these days.
Quite right.
And, it certainly hasn't destroyed our social structure at all. And so I think people need to recognize that individuals have rights. I mean, those are the only kind of rights there are, is individual rights.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Libertarian Party feels that, you know, all individuals, regardless of their sexual orientation, are individuals. They have an unlimited right to contract with whomever they want. And so we not only support gays' rights to be with one another, we question the government's authority to sanction marriages with any type of a license at all. This is a religious union, and it is really between, you know, those two people and whatever God they, you know, pray to. And if they want to go to the church and have the church bless and sanction their marriage, that's fine, because it would be a personal choice. But the government has no authority whatsoever to be granting permission to people, you know, for any type of a union.
All right. For the sake of time, we recently, of course, became burdened or blessed in the eyes of some, I suppose, with the Patriot Act. You would repeal it, wouldn't you?
I certainly would, and I'm flattered that you would know that in advance. The Patriot Act, for anybody who's cared to study it, was passed into law without Congress having the opportunity to read it. And they were so impressed with getting something done and doing something relative to September 11th that they neglected their responsibility to protect our rights and passed the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act is patently unconstitutional because it violates our Fourth Amendment rights to privacy, presumably allowing the government to come in and search your apartment without a search warrant. And it also violates the Sixth Amendment by allowing government to identify people arbitrarily as terrorists and therefore denying them the right to counsel and a right to a phone call and due process of law.
Michael, if you don't get to be president, and you may not, you may not win. I mean, realistically, you have to face up to that possibility. And we continue along with Democrats and Republicans for another, say, 20 years or so. And we continue on our present course and the present rate of erosion of our constitutional rights. At what point do you think you'd take a look at the Constitution and say, I don't recognize that we have any of those rights that are described there?
Well, depending on who you are, there are many of us that feel we may already be at that point.
Uh-huh.
And acknowledging that my chances of winning the White House are somewhat less than that of George Bush or John Kerry, nonetheless, we need to do the right thing. We need to promote individual rights and personal responsibility. And even if we don't win the White House this year, our goal is to bring new members into the party,
sure,
advance the libertarian message, and hopefully change the discussion of the political discussion before the election.
One part of political discussion is the affirmative action, and you know, for a lot of people feel that affirmative action did correct some past wrongs, and some people think that its time has come and gone and it should be abolished now. Others think it should be continued perhaps for many, many more years or forever. What do you think?
It's really a tricky problem. Clearly, slavery was
wrong,
totally unacceptable, because it violates the general idea that a person owns his or her own body.
Mm-hmm.
The bias against the minorities is fairly well obvious. And affirmative action certainly has a good and well-meaning basis behind it. The problem with affirmative action is that once you establish it, what we have to acknowledge is that affirmative action is a reverse bias. And that may be appropriate for some short period of time, but there is never any definitive explanation as to when that stops. How much of a bias do we have to give to the minorities until we have satisfied the wrongs? How do we know when the scales are back in balance? And realistically, I think that it is time for all races to be considered equal, for all races to have an equal opportunity, and to allow people to, you know, thrive or not based on their merits.
All right. And on that note, Michael, hold tight for just a second. We didn't, because of a piece of equipment here going berserker, we didn't get our first break in. We're going to do that right now and be right back. Once again, Michael Bednarik, who is the Libertarian Party's candidate for the presidency of the United States. And Michael, you would eliminate the IRS altogether, and that's something I've never been totally clear on myself. It sounds good, eliminate the IRS, but wow, we do have functions in government that must be funded. Our defense, I know libertarians believe that the country must be defended. That costs money. Roads and things like that. And so how do you eliminate the IRS and still have a functional government?
Well, the money that is collected by the IRS is less than 15% of the national budget, and eliminating it would stimulate the economy.
Oh, yes.
People would get approximately a 35% pay increase every paycheck,
right?
Not just a rebate of $300 of their own money.
Right.
The cost of goods and services is about 20% of that cost is goes to IRS regulations for the companies that have to withhold the money and stuff. So not only would people have more money in their take-home pay, the cost of goods and services would drop, and that would allow people to pay off credit cards, buy a better car,
sure,
put their children to a better school.
Sure.
And because of all this surplus money, small companies would spring up all over the place providing goods and services to attract some of that extra capital. And the economy would just flourish almost immediately.
Well, it certainly would. I mean, if everybody had 30% or so more money every payday,
that's
there'd be a flourishing, all right. But
and there, first of all, the Constitution establishes a limited federal government. There are a short list of things that government is allowed to do.
Defense is expensive.
Well, defense is expensive if you are doing international defense. We have military in 130 countries around the world. We still have soldiers in Germany, Japan, and Korea, and I don't think that it's really necessary for us to be protecting them.
So a libertarian defense wouldn't be that expensive because
it wouldn't
be
that expensive because we would only be defending the United States. And because we wouldn't be interfering with other governments, the likelihood that they would be upset with us enough to attack us would be reduced. So I would hope to be the first peace president. Instead of sending our soldiers into war all around the world, I would hope to make the world safer by, you know, not engaging in as many foreign interventions as possible.
All right, again, and this is important. For those who want to know more about this philosophy, more about Michael, and more about the Libertarian Party, give the website and phone number again.
They can go to www.lp.org. That's for libertarianparty.org. And the phone number is 1-800-682-1776. Again, that's 1-800-682-1776.
All right. It has been an absolute pleasure to have you with us this morning, and I wish you so very much luck in getting the message out and your campaign. Michael, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And good night.
Good night.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Kind of a short primer course on libertarianism, and if you want to know more, he just told you how. Coming up in a moment, Maurice Cottrell. Maurice Cottrell has written a book called The Terracotta Warriors and will answer questions like, I don't know, about life and death and all the rest of that. From the high desert in the middle of a mild night, I'm Art Bell.
Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The First Time Caller Line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
By the way, this song, which was used several times in a series on Showtime called Dead Like Me, Dead Like Me begins again, I think, with a new season this month. Looking forward to it. Speaking of dead and life, Maurice Cotterell is on his way. In 1989, engineer and scientist Maurice Cotterell, I hope I'm doing that right, found a way of calculating the duration of long-term magnetic reversals on our sun. Using that knowledge, he was able to break the codes of ancient sun-worshipping civilizations. First the Mayas of Central America, then those of Tutankhamun of Egypt. His unique decoding process reveals amazing pictures from archaeological treasures that explain the spiritual mysteries of life, why we're born, why we die, and why this has to be. His work, best described as adventure fact, I like that, adventure fact, brings together modern science, spirituality, and ancient wisdom to unlock the secrets of the past, present, and future in just a very short future. Here, from all the way over in Ireland, you know, I looked at the phone number, I said, oh wow, look at this, we're calling someplace I've never called before. West Cork, Ireland is Maurice Cotterell, and I hope I'm saying the name correctly, Maurice, am I?
That's fine, Art, yes.
Maurice Cotterell, well, you say it.
It's Maurice Cotterell.
Cotterell, okay. Okay, we'll do it that way. Before we launch into any of the other questions, all of this seems to spring from calculating the duration of long-term magnetic reversals on the sun. So what can you tell me about those? They're the basis of everything, right?
Absolutely, yes. And it's an inquiry I began many years ago. In my first career, I was a radio officer in the Merchant Navy.
Uh-huh.
And I used to have to communicate with the UK from far away places like South Africa and so on.
Yes.
And in the actual year which I left college at that time, 1970, there was a period of increased sunspot activity, and it was making communications very difficult from faraway places like South Africa.
I went through that, Maurice. I'm an amateur radio operator, and I'm on shortwave every single day, so I'm well familiar with our sun's cycle's effect on radio propagation.
It's a very interesting area. It's absolutely fascinating, actually. Not so much important these days with VHF and satellite, but in those days of shortwave, where shortwave was the only means of communication.
Oh, it's still fascinating, Maurice, still fascinating.
Absolutely. And in those days, of course, even today, shortwave radio signals bounce off the sky, the ionosphere. So when the sun went through a period of intense magnetic activity, it showered particles towards the Earth. And that disrupts the upper atmosphere and prevents the radio signals from propagating effectively.
Mm-hmm.
So I became very interested in the sun, in the propagation of radio waves. And I was aware that the sunspot cycle was approximately about 11 or 11 and a half years. And what we mean by the sunspot cycle is thousands of years ago, the ancient Chinese noticed black spots on the sun's surface and that these were periodic and cyclic in nature. They reached a maximum, then they reached a minimum every 11 years or so. Now, I was particularly fascinated because I was also interested in Chinese astrology at the time and also Western astrology. And being on board ship, it was a wonderful place to study human behavior.
Mm-hmm.
People were often away from home for long periods of time. And it was a wonderful microcosm to examine how people reacted in a very vulnerable position, if you like, when they were away from family and friends. The first trip, we actually went to Hong Kong, and it was there I became very interested in the 12-year Chinese astrological cycle, which legend has it that when Buddha was dying, he called all the animals of the kingdom together, and 12 animals arrived. It was the rat, the ox, the cat, the tiger, the dragon, the snake, the horse, the sheep, the monkey, the rooster, the dog, and the pig. and he assigned each of those animals a year in the zodiacal calendar. And our personalities depend on which year we are actually born in, so the Chinese believed. So I started to consider how personality could be determined over a 12-year cycle, and clearly the obvious candidate for that was the 11.5-year sunspot cycle. Could the two events be connected? So I started to look at the sun in great depth over the years that followed, looking and also into genetic mutations, how genetic mutations might be caused by the sun's radiation, because clearly the behavioral theorists of the 1920s, Sigmund Freud and so on, believed that personality was a function of genetic makeup. Therefore, if astrology were to be shown to be effective and valid, then we would have to show a link between genetic makeup and personality.
You know, Maurice, I was able to go, fortunate enough to go to the Vatican in Rome, and we walked in, and the first thing we saw was this gigantic globe with every single astrological sign on it that there is. You know, I mean, all the normal astrological signs that we're used to, and it took my breath away. I went, what is that doing here? So apparently, this is a very, very old belief system. I had no idea that Catholicism at any point embraced this.
Absolutely. All of the, well, it gets more interesting as we'll, you know, this evening as we discuss this, because it's a very, very wide-ranging area. And it's easy to jump in and pick and mix, but then the whole picture can get very confused. But I agree that certainly the Christian church, all of the ancient civilizations, were aware of the movements of the heavens. And what we find in particular with the sun-worshipping civilizations is that they believed the sun was the god of fertility and the god of astrology. And the Central American sun-worshipping civilizations believed that the sun was responsible for periodic destruction of life on Earth every few thousand years.
Really?
For example, the Mayas and the Aztecs believed that the Earth had been destroyed on four previous occasions over the last 20,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And once we start to pull all of this evidence together and start to analyze it, we begin to realize that there was method in what their belief system. For example, what I discovered was, as I started to study the sun, was that the sun spins every 28 days. And it was only as I was growing up, for example, when Mariner 2 spacecraft was launched in 1962, that we realized that the sun showers particles towards the Earth. And then another discovery in 1979 by Professor Ian Nicholson in the UK, he discovered that when these negative and positive particles from the sun bombard with the Van Allen belts around the Earth's atmosphere, then the Earth's magnetic field modulates and changes.
Mm-hmm.
It was later in 1989 where Professor Ross Adey, an Australian doctor working for President Reagan as the chief medical advisor in the USA, discovered that when you bombard certain animals, pigeons, rats, guinea pigs, with modulating magnetic fields, then the amount of melatonin in the brain changes.
Mm.
And we know that melatonin affects the endocrine system directly and also the sex hormones, estrogen and progesterone. So when I looked at the sun showering particles every 28 days, I immediately saw this picture in my mind, which showed that the particles change the magnetic field every 28 days. Mm. The magnetic field changed the hormones in the brains, and the brains change the endocrine production of the fertility hormones, estrogen and progesterone. So the ancient civilizations were correct. The sun is the god of fertility. It does affect fertility.
Huh. So, isn't that something, how so many old things that are thought to be just mythical and primitive actually were right on the money?
Absolutely. And it even extends to their belief in astrology and their sacred years and their solar years. All of this stuff has a very, very scientific, rational basis to it.
Does astrology itself, as we know about it, have a good, solid basis to it? In other words, for example, people are born under certain sun signs, and then certain attributes are attributed to these particular people, and doggone if it doesn't seem mostly right. You know, it has to me anyway.
Yeah, there's no question whatsoever that the sun causes genetic mutations at the moment of gestation, during gestation, while the fetus is growing in the womb. Now, when I examined the radiation coming off the sun as it spins, I discovered four different sequences of radiation over a four-month period. So we got month one, a certain radiation comes off the sun. Month two, it's different. Month three, it's different. Month four, it's different. Then it all repeats again. And what that means is a child born on the first month will have the same genetic mutations as one born on month five and month nine.
Uh-huh.
And this is why we have four, what astrologers refer to as elemental groups, earth, air, fire, and water.
Maurice, have they been able to actually scientifically confirm those specific timelines with I don't know, some sort of genetic examination? I mean, is this science we're talking about now? Can they actually find these mutations in people born in these time segments?
Well, it's empirical right now. It's very, very difficult. We're not yet that advanced to actually study the genetic mutations and correlate them with modulations of solar radiation.
But you believe we will find that correlation when we get...
Well, we've got a correlation. I mean, in my books, if readers read any of my books...
No, I meant we'll find a real verifiable... When we get far enough in genetics, we're going to bump into this.
Absolutely. No question about it.
Okay.
It's a question of having the technology to identify which mutations are caused by which radiation sequences. And that is like the DNA genome program itself. There's so many possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
We can generalize and say that somebody born in the first month, for example, Aries, thinks the same way as somebody born in Leo, who thinks the same way as somebody born in Sagittarius, because they were all mutated by a similar radiation pattern at the moment of conception. So they all think the same way, because the personality, we believe, is determined by genetic makeup. And it's not just the sun sign astrology, the determination of personality. What we also see, if we examine the radiation coming off the sun, is that as this radiation flows to Earth, it's like a beam of electrons in a cathode ray tube, like a TV or a computer screen. And we can compare the sun to the cathode of the tube, which releases electrons. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's the gun, if you like, inside the TV tube.
Sure.
Now, when planets, so for example, the inner planets, Venus and Mercury, come in the way of the beam, then the magnetic fields and the gravitational fields of those planets distort the beams disproportionately, just as the intermediary guns in a cathode ray tube will swing the beam across the screen for a very, very tiny change in voltage.
Right.
It has a tremendous effect. So we get a degree of variance introduced because of the planets. Also, the outer planets, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto, they have the ability to accelerate electrons from the sun when they're in line with the sun. So they can, as the electrons impinge upon the Earth's Van Allen belts, they have more of a magnetic impact. And again, when those planets are on the opposite side of the sun, it's like a neap tide as against the spring tide, if we compare it to water,
yes.
Then the electrons will be reduced and their energy as they collide with the Earth will be reduced.
Wouldn't a conventional scientific theory here, Maurice, suggest and argue with what you've just said, that in fact the magnetic influence or change would be so minute, I'm sure they would agree there would be one, but it would be so minute that to have any effect, to imagine any large effect, is ludicrous.
No, that's not true. In 1984, a team of scientists at Bethesda in Maryland University
mm-hmm.
Discovered that the magnetic fields from the lighting in the laboratory was causing genetic mutations to test tube experiments that were going on.
Oh, no kidding.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. That was in 1984. And what they discovered was that the degree of genetic mutations were caused by magnetic fields of an amplitude less than that of the Earth's own magnetic field.
Oh, that's fascinating. Fascinating.
Yeah, so it proves that the Earth's magnetic field is capable of having the same effect. So, no, they're not that tiny, and they're very, very important. And I can't understand for the life of me why people just won't accept that there's a scientific rationale that explains how astrology works. Even the biorhythmic side of it, the sun spins every 28 days, and during that 28 days, we have four sequences of radiation, positive, negative, positive, negative. And this is the derivation of biorhythms. We're in a synchronization with the radiation, which determined our personality in the beginning. So when we get a return of that radiation, months and years later, and dozens of years later, we have good years and bad years, and we have good weeks and bad weeks. So we're more accident-prone at certain times. And again, there have been lots of scientific inquiries by Professor Hans Eysenck, for example, at the London School of Psychiatry, where he's examined that people have more accidents on solar days, which are very active,
mm-hmm.
and less accidents where it's very calm and so on. So we already have the evidence. The scientific evidence is with us.
I've been watching, Maurice, you may wish to comment on this, for quite a while. I thought I had begun to see a correlation between our sun cycles and earthquake activity as well. And I wonder if you've watched that. I've gone through, watched several sun cycles very carefully, and I thought I've noticed that correlation.
I haven't personally. It's not an area I've inquired into. However, it may be one I may inquire into because I have considered it. The reason is these solar cycles affect Earth in many other ways. We've discovered we've talked about the determination of personality. We've talked about the 28-day menstruation regulation. The sun's cycles go, as I discovered when I was working at Cranfield, have a 187-year period, which is 68,302 days. There's also a longer cycle of 18,169 years. And during this cycle, the solar radiation changes. So, not surprisingly, as a consequence, the amount of fertility on Earth changes. It goes up and down. That's why civilizations are born and civilizations die away throughout history. Another effect of sunspot cycles is that they introduce mini ice ages onto Earth.
I'm sorry, mini what?
Mini ice ages. We get cold spells.
Ice ages, oh yes.
And that leads to drought in equatorial regions and crop failure. And again, another reason, it explains why certain civilizations disappeared at certain times during the world's history. Another cycle which occurs on the sun's surface is a 3,740-year neutral sheet cycle. And this is when the neutral sheet cycle of the sun flips its magnetic polarity. Now, the neutral sheet is quite a simple concept, actually. We would imagine that the sun would be all north at the North Pole mm-hmm. and all south at the South Pole.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, at any particular snapshot, the middle of the Earth would be neutral around the equator. But in fact, we now know from observations that the neutral sheet is warped and tilted. And this moves. We now know from the sunspot cycle examination that this neutral sheet shifts every 187 years, and it takes 18,169 years to get back to where it started.
I've heard so much about these cycles. Michael, we're at the bottom of the hour, so hold tight for a second. Again, these same cycles from so many of my guests, ranging in just about the same number of years. Fascinating, absolutely fascinating, the whole cycle business, because, well, I'm beginning to conclude there absolutely does have to be something to it. Maurice Cotterell is my guest from West Cork, Ireland, all the way from Ireland. I'm Art Bell. Middle of the night on a nice, mild desert night.
Riders on the storm. Riders on the storm. Into this house we're born.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
My guest is Maurice Cutterell, all the way from West Cork, Ireland. It's going to be a very interesting evening. First of all, what he's had to say makes perfect sense. I have many, many more questions, and I know he has many more answers. He's going to explain the difference between the body and soul, explain why we're born, why we die, and why that has to be. Then, I guess, explain what God is and what heaven is, and also what hell is. I wonder, Maurice, whether you've ever considered that the ancients and even some modern day isolated civilizations that have been found to worship the sun, were they wrong?
Absolutely not. In fact, they were far more advanced than we are today. And just going back to your previous question before the break, Art, because that will lead us on to what we were talking, onto the spiritual side.
Sure.
You were asking about whether solar cycles might influence earthquakes on Earth.
Yes.
And what I found once I started to look at the longer-term cycles on the sun, the 3,740-year neutral sheet cycle, was that when the magnetic neutral sheet flips, the Earth has a propensity to turn upside down on its axis. And, of course, when that happens, we're completely destroyed through earthquakes, hurricanes, volcanic activity, and so on. Now, the last time this occurred, if we are to learn from the Mayan civilization, they started their calendar in the year 3113 BC, mm-hmm. more than 5,000 years ago. Now, of course, they weren't even around in 3113 BC. So it was they must have had a very good reason for starting a calendar which appeared 3,000 years before themselves.
Good point.
And what happened then was that a neutral sheet cycle began, which they were aware of. They knew that 3,740 years later, the magnetic field would flip, Venus would flip upside down, and the magnetic twist wasn't strong enough to twist the Earth. And this is why Venus today turns around backwards. It goes all the other way. It goes the opposite way to all the other planets.
And how did they know that? What knowledge did they have to know that?
Well, first of all, we have to show a scientific approach, a rational approach to all of these questions. We can't just say, I think, or
yes.
Could it be?
Yes.
We have to go one step at a time logically, and then the answers become apparent and quite clear.
All right.
If we look at the 3,740-year cycle, they refer to that date as the birth of Venus in 3113 BC, and the number there is 1366560 days, 1,366,560 days. Now, that number is carved on a pyramid in Mexico. Now, it took me years to calculate that on the largest computer in the world, that duration, that period. So the Mayas were clearly far, far more intelligent than we are today. So I went down to the Mayan Ceremonial Center at Palenque in Mexico, and this was in 1989, and I started to look at all of their treasures in a different way, looking for evidence of the sun worship, fertility worship, and so on. And I was absolutely amazed, clearly, at what I found. Just going back to the Ice Ages, the Earth did not tilt upside down in 3113 BC. But what happens then, when the Earth doesn't flip, but Venus did, is that we have a magnetic misalignment between the Sun and the Earth. So we get eddy currents flowing in the Earth's magma. So the Earth's magma tends to heat up. And this causes volcanic activity and, of course, stresses inside the Earth, which can lead to earthquakes and tectonic movements.
Mm-hmm.
So when we don't flip upside down, there is a delay as the Earth heats up over thousands of years, and then the catastrophe still happens.
But on a on a smaller scale, Maurice, then we are, if it is correct, observing some shaking according to at a smaller scale, according to how the sun is modulating through the normal 11.5 year cycle.
Absolutely, all the time we are absolutely dependent on the sun in every way for fertility, for clearly for rainfall, ice ages, mini
yes.
ice ages.
Yes,
it extends throughout our whole life and mankind's survival. The sun is all important, and clearly we need to understand it better.
All right, doing the numbers, I'll probably never understand all the number part of this, Maurice, but it's an obvious question. When might we, what sort of expectation with regard to a timeline for the next real shift?
Well, that would be 3,740 years after the last one, and the last one was in 750 AD for the Mayas. So, I mean, if we work that out, we've got the year 4,490 AD, which is a long time from now.
Sounds good.
But curiously, the Mayas believed a new cosmic cycle will begin in the year 2012.
Oh.
Now, that's interesting because although there's no scientific evidence to support that, they may have been telling us that although the magnetic flip occurred in 750 AD, causing infertility and decline of the Mayan civilization, and a mini ice age, and drought, and crop failure, and so on. It wiped out the Mayas, but that's when this internal heating of the planet may have begun. So they may have been in possession of better information than we have at this time, and that's probably the case. So whether or not something's going to happen in 2012 is difficult to say. The reference to 2012 occurs in the books of Chilam Balam, or the books of the Jaguar, the books of the sun, because the Jaguar was a metaphor for the sun. It was a golden sun with a brown spots. And in the books of Chilam Balam, which is a 17th century document, translated by Ralph Royce in the 20th century, it says that in the year 2012, there will be infertility and famine.
Hmm.
And that seems to fit in with the magnetic reversal.
Certainly does.
Infertility,
yeah.
Because of a disruption in fertility hormones and crop failure due to mini ice age and so on, lower temperatures. So it all makes sense. It's all logical. And if we go down to Palenque now and look at the ceremonial center, we realize that they encoded this information in their treasures. And it raises a question straight away. Why would any civilization encode this super scientific information into their treasures?
Yeah, it ought to be big, bold headlines for the next to come along.
Well, it's not quite like that, because they're telling us that they're very clever. That's the first thing. It's something that we can just about relate to now with our computers and our understanding of astronomy and physics and atomic structures and so on. They were very much aware of all of these things. And they knew that we would not realize the extent of their knowledge until we had computers. So a lot of the information couldn't be decoded until a computer appeared as recently as 20 years ago.
Fascinating.
If you look at my website, you'll see some of the pictures, for example, which were made, decoded pictures from the treasures of the Maya, which were only made possible because we are now living in the computer age.
All right.
Nobody before me could have had access to that information. It
All
would
right.
have been impossible.
All right, Maurice, if they, I can understand that. It's kind of like the case that's made for the Bible code, just as an example, that we weren't meant to find it until we had the ability to find it.
Exactly.
Fine. Assuming that that's the case, is there, when this cycle comes due, whether it's the end of the Mayan calendar or on out to 4,000, whenever it is there any information decoded which indicates that there's one damn thing anybody can do about it? Or is it simply knowledge to have to get ready to move on to the next life?
It's a little bit of both.
Uh-huh.
Now, the real, once we start to examine the decoded pictures, that's when we start to make progress, because the pictures tell us what we are discovering as it unfolds. And they tell us that the knowledge is primarily spiritual, and it tells us what this life's all about. You touched on earlier what the body is, what the soul is, what heaven is, what hell is,
that's
what purgatory
right.
is.
Absolutely.
All of this stuff is described in their pictures. The reason they use pictures or numbers, I mean, the Bible uses numbers, 666, 144,000, and so on. There's a good reason for that. They believed in reincarnation, and they wanted to get to heaven. And they knew that if they didn't get to heaven this time around, then they'd come back to earth for another chance at soul purification. And they knew that in the next life, they probably wouldn't get to heaven. Because as the Egyptians told us, with the preservation of their internal organs, although they preserved the liver, the lungs, the heart, and the liver, the lungs, the stomach, and the intestines, they didn't preserve the heart and the brain. And the Egyptians were trying to tell us that when we reincarnate, we have a new brain with a new intellectual memory and a new heart with a new emotional memory. So if we start life with a clean CD drive, if you like, our brains are wiped clean every time we come back, we've just as much chance of getting to heaven next time as we did this time. And given that we didn't make it this time, there's no chance of getting there next time. So they decided to encode all of this information into their treasures so that when they came back next time, they could decode the information, learn all of that knowledge that had taken thousands of years to accumulate, reach a spiritual understanding which would accommodate purification of the spirit and get them to heaven in the next life. So they had to encode this information. Now, why do they encode it? Well, clearly, they've got to encode it because it could be damaged. It has to stand the ravages of time. They might not be reincarnated for 3,000 years. So they have to wrap it up in pyramids or carvings somewhere where it won't get burnt, it won't get wet, and so on. It has to be packaged. It has to be formatted. Uh-huh. If they reincarnate in Mexico 3,000 years later, they may not speak the Quiche language anymore. Maybe the Spanish have invaded, and they speak a Spanish language. So there's no good encoding information in a particular language. It has to be a universal language, which they will understand in the future.
My God, that's incredible. So they're leaving themselves a message.
Exactly. And the best way to leave yourself a message is in pictures or numbers, because even if we have a catastrophic destruction of civilization, sooner or later we get up on our feet and we start to walk again, and we start to count using our 10 fingers. So every civilization used a base 10 decimal system, and they also clearly understood pictures, because a picture is common to all languages and it's worth 1,000 words.
Well, then they obviously believe very strongly in reincarnation.
Absolutely. Now, and this is the spiritual side, they also encoded it to encrypt it, to make sure that people who shouldn't have access to this information, bad people who don't deserve to go to heaven, won't discover it.
Right.
You know, we can't have everybody going to heaven.
Right.
And there's a reason for that, as we'll see shortly. If everybody went to heaven at the same time, there'd be a real problem in the universe. So that can't happen. So just as it says in the Bible, as Jesus says, unto you it is given to know the mysteries of God, but to others in parables. And parables are pictures in the mind. Don't forget, they make pictures in the mind. That seeing they might not see, and hearing they might not understand. In other words, those who are not ready to go to heaven are denied access to the information. Also, another reason for encoding is that those who understand this higher knowledge are older souls. In the physical world, we have young bodies and old bodies.
Yes.
And in the soul world, we have old souls and young souls. And whilst it would be folly to try to teach a 3-year-old child algebra in the physical world, because the child isn't ready for algebra, it's folly to try and get a new soul, a young soul, to heaven, because they're not ready for the information.
Maurice, on what basis did they believe so strongly in reincarnation? On what did they base that on?
On Einstein's equation he used in relativity, E equals MC squared, basically. And what that means is, if you look at all of the scriptures and all of the religious dissertations,
yes,
throughout all of the religions, they all agree that God is light. In the Bible, in the first place, God made light. But if we look at the Bhagavad Gita, it says God is light.
Yes.
We now know that light is electromagnetic energy. It's a voltage. Straightforward. We don't have to make this stuff up. We're told what it is. We just have to look at it using a modern approach, using a scientific approach.
Yes, but that energy that you speak of, that I understand, but what leads them to believe it retains a coherent form?
came. As Einstein says, E equals mc squared. Energy
yes.
equals mass times the speed of light squared.
Yes.
So if God is energy and God made the physical universe, then God must have sacrificed a piece of his energy and it must have crossed Einstein's equation and become mass. That's when we had the Big Bang.
Yes, I someone said that to me once, and I thought it was elegant, that what happened at the Big Bang is God blew himself up.
It is, yes, exactly.
Now,
what we have to remember is that it's a simple equation, a simple algebraic equation. When the energy goes to the other side of the equation, we have to change the sign. So if God is positive E, if we move God to the other side of the equation, relative to the God, the mass is negative. Positive changes its sign. Very simple. But that's very profound, because what it means is that everything in the world of mass, in the physical world of tangible things,
mm-hmm.
is the opposite to God. What that means is that the universe is hell, and that everything in hell is the devil. So we're starting to understand now where we are and what we are. Everything that you can see in front of you is the devil and is hell, including your fingers and your toes. So how can we reconcile God with being in hell? Well, what happens is when your fetus begins to grow in the womb, it develops a voltage as a current start flowing through your brain. Voltages are developed, and those voltages must be the opposite to God because we're in hell.
By the way, Maurice, perhaps you can settle a bit of an argument. When does that voltage develop in the fetus?
It seems... I can answer. It's not a problem. Biologically, from the moment electrical currents start to flow through the cells as the cells start to divide.
Yes.
But when, and what happens is it grows then on a daily basis and an hourly basis, and it reaches a certain voltage, a threshold voltage, let's say 10 millivolts after 8 or 9 months. And after it reaches that 10 volts, it attracts down a 10-volt soul from God. So as the voltage reaches minus 10 volts in the fetus, in the womb, it rips off 10 microvolts of positive voltage from God. So we get a bubble of energy attaching to the soul, plus 10 microvolts attaches to minus 10 microvolts. So the voltage is zero. It cancels out. But then we become a human being, half God, half devil. And this is why we're always arguing in our own minds, intellectually, as to what is right and what is wrong.
Yes.
The body wants to do one thing, but the soul wants to do something else.
Oh, that's fascinating. Fascinating.
Now, what we're told by the ancients as we start to decode their treasures is that there are several worlds. There's the intellectual world of the intellectual body. There's
mm-hmm.
the physical body, the emotional body, and the spiritual body.
Mm-hmm.
And these four bodies, they exist in different rules. There are different rules for each of these bodies. For example, in the physical world, if I have a dollar and you have a dollar and we exchange them, we finish up with a dollar each. We can't get something for nothing in the physical world. In the intellectual world, if I have an idea and you have an idea and we exchange them, I finish up with two ideas. You finish up with two ideas. We can double our intellectual wealth at no cost. Taking this one step further, if I love you, I can increase my soul voltage. If I increase my soul voltage, when my soul leaves my body, it goes back to God, and God grows. In this way, mankind can be seen as a conduit for God growth. We accommodate God growth. If I hate you during my physical life, then my soul voltage will go down, so much so that when it leaves my body, it will reincarnate, it will reattach to a lower voltage fetus in another womb. And in the next life, on Earth, and don't forget this is hell, and all the religions believed it was hell. Because if you take, for example, Christianity, Christianity believes in the notion of body and soul. It believes in heaven and hell. Heaven for those who have purified themselves, hell for those who have not. What we've seen from Einstein's equation is this is hell. So Christianity, therefore, explicitly recognizes reincarnation, just as do the Hindus and many of the world's religions. So what we find is that the soul is entombed in this body for 70 years, and it's like being in an elevator. First, our soul voltage goes up as we love people because we're born rich, but then in the next life, we'll come will come back as a poor person, because the first will be the last will be first.
Got it. All right, Maurice, we've got a break here at the top of the hour. This really is fascinating. I've always said higher voltage is a ham, is real heaven. And I guess higher voltage is heaven. Anyway, we're going to break here at the top of the hour. We'll be right back. I'm Art Bell from the high desert, where it's about 78.4 degrees right now at near midnight on the Pacific Coast. Stay right there.
Miss part of the show? Listen online with Streamlink. Log on to coasttocoastam.com. Call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Oh, God, this is fascinating stuff. Maurice Cotterell is my guest, and he's telling us that civilizations come and civilizations go on a regular basis. Granted, many thousands of years, but they come and they're destroyed, and they go, and then they come again, and those who lived through that figured it out, encoded the information, and laid it away for themselves in pictures and other ways, so that we could figure it out when the time came for spiritual reasons, to get ourselves ready for what was coming. But I wonder if there could have been more. Hey, listen, folks, I interviewed somebody. Remember Sir Charles Schultz III? I interviewed him, I don't know, some time ago, and oh, my God, what a brilliant man. He'll be here. He'll be back tomorrow night. I told you he'd be back. He's really something. You don't want to miss that. Right now, we're in the middle of something you definitely don't want to miss. The whole concept of one entire civilization figuring it out and leaving a message for themselves because they knew they would be reincarnated. That's by itself totally fascinating. And you said that the information really is contained, or contains information about spiritual preparation for an event that is inevitable. Now, I wonder, Maurice, if it is ultimately inevitable, or if perhaps some civilization at some technological developed point of view could use the information to, in some way, prevent what otherwise is going to happen.
It would seem not, Art, and that's because of the nature of the destruction, which is always catastrophic. And of course, we're not dealing with one civilization who understood this knowledge. We're dealing with every sun-worshipping civilization throughout history.
Right.
So at first when I started to discover all this with the sunspot cycle, and I laid it all out in the Mayan prophecies in 1995, I then scratched my head for a couple of years thinking, but how on earth could they have figured out all of this information, which has taken me years and years to figure out using the world's largest computer? I then realized that I'd made a slight and simple mistake. The pictures that I decoded, which are on the website, by the way, www.morriscottrell.com, you can actually see these decoded pictures, a few of them. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds. There's just a handful on the web. What I realized was that these pictures were actually living miracles, and I'd made a mistake in imagining that the Mayas, mere human beings, could have produced miracles. It was almost as though I'd imagined, to use an analogy, that everybody in Judea could walk on the water 2,000 years ago, or everybody in Judea 2,000 years ago could turn water into wine or heal the sick with the bare hands. And, of course, it's not true. There are stories that one man could do all of those things.
Yes.
And so I began to realize then that it was more likely that one man produced these living miracles that we can now see with the aid of the computer. And, of course, that man was the leader of the Mayas, Lord Peikal, the priest-king, around 750 A.D., And once I started to decode the pictures told me that he had lived before as Buddha and Tutankhamun. And the information started to come together. Now, Lord Peikal was known as Quetzalcoatl, the feathered snake. Tutankhamun carried the eagle and the snake on his forehead. Mm. Tutankhamun means the living image of God, Tutankhamun, which is the son of God. And what I began to notice when I started to inquire as to these religious leaders who the pictures told me had lived on many occasions before is that they shared much in common. When they were born, they were all born through an immaculate conception. And I'm talking about Lord Krishna of the Hindu. I'm talking about Tutankhamun. I'm talking about Jesus, Viracochas of Peru, Lord Peikal of the Maya. If we look at all of the information, they all tell us the same story about their own leader. They were born through an immaculate conception. When they were born, a bright star was seen in the sky. They performed miracles. When they died, they all went to Venus. They became the planet Venus. In the Bible, Jesus says, on the last page of the Bible, I, Jesus, am the bright and shining morning star. Now, Venus was the twin star. We have Venus sometimes appears on the left-hand side of the sun in the morning, and 274 days later on the right-hand side of the sun, mm-hmm. as it goes around the sun.
Right.
And it's the brightest source of light and the purest source of light in the heavens, so it's
yes.
identified with love. And what we find is, if we look at the tomb of Tutankhamun, we see Tutankhamun in a painting as two twins embracing Osiris. So when he dies and leaves his body, he goes to Venus. He becomes Venus in the heavens for resurrection and everlasting life. If we look at the Bible, as I say, the Bible says Jesus went to Venus. If we look at Lord Peikal in the amazing lid of Palenque, we see him being reborn as Venus, as the twins in the heaven. And once I started to examine these super teachers, these spiritual teachers, which I call super gods, which resulted in the book The Super Gods in 1997, I began to realize that Lord Krishna, which is Krishna means Christ in Greek, it means the anointed one, it's the same word. Krishna was the eighth incarnation of Vishnu, of the Indian Holy Trinity, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva. He came back as Buddha. The Hindus believe that Buddha was the eighth incarnation of Krishna. And they say that Buddha will come back again. Now, Buddha's mother was called Maya. And, of course, Lord Peikal was the leader of the Maya. Tutankhamun's tomb was designed by an architect called Maya. His wet nurse was called Maya. And when we start to look at the similarities between all of these religious leaders, we realize that the pictures we see, the moving pictures that we see, the decoded pictures from the treasures, the carvings of the Maya, it tells us that it's the same spiritual energy coming back to Earth every few thousand years or every few hundred years to teach us about how to purify our souls. Mm-hmm. And this Son of God is the great reaper, if you like. He's the guy that comes down and he markets the spiritual and esoteric philosophies and leaves the information behind in the treasures of that civilization. So wherever we see a super god, wherever we see sun worship of a very high scientific order, we know that a teacher walked among them, a Christ-like figure, whether it was in Peru in AD 100, we have Viracocha, who was the foam of the sea, the perfect being. were only perfect when we were in the foam of the sea, in communion with earth, air, fire, and water. And it was a metaphor for the perfect being. 200 years later, we had the second arrival of Viracocha, the white man who walked through Peru performing miracles, healing the sick with his bare hands. All these accounts are well documented. And again, we know that the leaders, the Viracochas, were known as feathered snakes, like Lord Peikal, Tutankhamun. This feathered snake referred to, on a technical level, the sunspot cycle, which resembles a feathered snake. We can see this diagrammatically. Also, in the simple sense, it meant that the eagle represented the soul in the sky, and the snake represented the body which shed its skin and reincarnated on Earth.
So each civilization gets its own teacher.
Each civilization gets its own teacher, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Might I ask you a question, please, about the pyramids? I've done so much over the years on them, looked at them, studied them, talked to scholars. What were the pyramids' purpose?
Well, it would seem an attempt to set down their knowledge in stone for themselves in the future, as were the treasures of all of the other ancient sun worshipping civilizations. The best theory I've ever come across for the purpose of the Great Pyramid at Giza mm-hmm. was Christopher Dunn's book, The Giza Power Plant, which I found very interesting. Basically, he's saying that he believes that the Egyptians built the pyramid to generate power to manufacture their precision-engineered products. Now, I disagree with the last bit, but if you actually read the book, it's fascinating. And clearly, they didn't need a power plant to manufacture precision pieces of engineering.
Are there not others, Maurice, who believe that the pyramids virtually launched souls?
Well, excuse me, this is what I was about to say. Christopher Dunn's book, although it's very good, stops short in one or two areas.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what he's saying is it was a microwave generator, mm-hmm. and I tend to agree with him. And it seems to me that the souls of the pharaohs could be hitched to microwave energy and fired to the stars to escape the Earth's gravitational pull, if you like. Now, that seems a more rational explanation for having a microwave generator inside the pyramid rather than to produce power per se. In other words, the soul modulates the microwave beam. The microwave beam goes to the stars. And it seems that we can actually become a star. I mean, this is the next step in evolution. I've only talked about getting to heaven, becoming one with God. But it seems that we could, the soul can actually become a star in the sky, a nuclear furnace. And that star gives birth to its own planets. And then the planets, through evolution and time, produce living beings. Those living beings purify themselves and make the sun bigger, the star bigger. So we go on to a next step of evolution. So stars can be seen as living things, as packages of electromagnetic energy.
Yes.
So, yes, there could well be an explanation of that type to explain the pyramids themselves. But if we look at the treasures of Tutankhamun, which of course came 2,000 years after the pyramids, he's quite explicit in what he tells us. He tells us exactly the same as Lord Peikal. He tells us that the sun is responsible for fertility, mini ice ages, X-ray bombardment and infertility. All of the treasures of the tomb of Tutankhamun say exactly the same things in numbers and pictures, as do the treasures of all of the other sun-worshipping civilizations.
So then, could our own sun be an old soul?
It would appear so in such a model, yes.
Fascinating to even imagine it this way, and yet somehow it is making sense to me. It is making sense to me. So then, do we imagine all the stars to be living matter, souls, part of the God body itself?
When I wrote the Tutankhamun Prophecies in 1999, I originally entitled it Galaxies of Kings. And yes, I saw each of the stars as living souls. And that was the fascinating thing for me, that once we can throw off this body like an old raincoat, we can move on. But we can only move on when we're ready to move on, when the voltage is high enough, when we start to radiate light, radiate a halo. When our voltage is very, very pure and high, then we're ready for the next stage of our journey. But we're told in all the ancient texts that in order to make the voltage higher, we have to control the senses. And in the Bhagavad Gita, the Indian book, the holy book, which is part of the epic poem, the Mahabharata, it tells us that it compares the body to a team of horses which pull a chariot. And the horses refer to the five senses of sight, sound, touch, taste, and smell. And the body can lead the horses to run wild. And it's up to the soul, the passenger, the charioteer, to control the horses with the reins, and the reins are represented by the intellect. So if the soul wishes to have a peaceful journey, it must control the body using the reins. Otherwise, the horses will drag it to destruction.
Well, I have a feeling I personally don't have enough voltage to dimly light an LED low-voltage bulb right now. So I'm curious, by what measure do we understand where we are voltage-wise and where we are soul-wise, individually? Is there any manner of understanding how mature our soul is?
Yes, there is. Wisdom comes through knowledge. And knowledge, once it's assimilated and brought together, gives us a clearer picture of what is required of us, and the knowledge which we're talking about tonight. And Jesus simplified the message by saying, love God and love your neighbor. Once you've done that, you know you're ready for the next step of the journey. Now, of course, it's very difficult to love our neighbor. But once you've achieved that, you will be on the heavenly path, the narrow way, and you will be on your way to heaven. And if you can sit there this evening and say, well, you know, I don't love everybody in the world, you know, you love your own children more than other people's children, then you're not yet ready to go to heaven.
I'm in trouble. No doubt about that. I knew that. And there just are not many, there aren't many, maybe perhaps a few, I don't know. I mean, it seems by that measure, Maurice, that a very few souls indeed move on to heaven or at all.
Well, exactly. And, of course, in due course, souls purify themselves. It's a natural progression in time. And, of course, God's got all the time in the world, so to speak, because there is no such thing as time in the spirit world.
Right.
If we look before the Big Bang, there was nothing. All we had was light, and nothing happened. Nothing happened before anything else, and nothing happened after anything else. So nothing happened, so there's no such thing as time. But when God sacrificed a piece of his energy, it went to the other side of the equation, became the Big Bang, the physical universe was created. We had night, we had day, we had hot, we had cold, we had time began, events started to unfold one after the other. So time only exists in the physical world. So we must not be despondent when we say that we're not ready for heaven, because we've got thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years.
So time then, Maurice, is only an artifact of hell.
Exactly.
Oh, brother. Fascinating. Yeah, sure. Only in the physical material world do we have time. And so that's part of hell, which is the physical material world.
Yes. And it's only when we start to see other people as souls, loving souls, as pieces of God, which we are. Each of us is half God, half devil. Once you can see the God in people, you love the God, not the body. That's when you can love your neighbor. Now, of course, God was very clever. He wanted to make sure that people didn't go to heaven by mistake, for example.
Oh.
So he made sure that the 6 billion people all looked different to each other. That way, you could tell your own child from somebody else's child, because only your child would look like you.
Right.
That way, you would love your child. And the interesting thing is, in the Bible, nowhere does it say you should love your children. What it says is you should love your neighbor's children more than yourself. You should love your neighbor. And this stops, I mean, if ever all the children looked alike, I mean, the obvious way, if you're manufacturing anything, whether you're Henry Ford manufacturing a Model T Ford, you make them all the same. It's a lot easier. It makes life simple. All the spare parts are the same. It's dead easy. So why did God make life difficult for himself by making 6 billion people all different?
Yes.
And it's because he wanted to make sure people would be tricked, fooled into believing that their children belong to them, when in fact they're alien souls. They're nothing to do with them whatsoever. But they see them as a piece of themselves, and the ego side of the individual relates to the, they imagine that this biological entity is a piece of them. But of course, once they get to the age of 11, the hormones start flowing, you realize they're complete strangers, and that three brothers are completely different to the three sisters. They're all different to each other because they're all different souls. They've got nothing whatsoever to do with a biological parent who created the fetus in the womb.
It's just a little bit of voltage that jumped, that's all, huh?
Exactly. What happened was the biological parents produced a lump of meat in the womb.
Yeah.
That lump of meat dragged down a soul commensurate to it, what it had earned in its previous life. So if it was a bad lump of meat, it dragged down a low-voltage soul. If it was a good lump of meat, it drags down a good lump of soul.
Well, though, there are genetic similarities that we can document between parent and child, right?
There are genetic, and it does seem that if we look at the pictures and the text, that men come back as women come back as men, the first will be last, the last will be first, rich, poor, first, and so on. And it does seem that when the soul reincarnates, it comes back into the same family. And this is why the Mayans, the mother goddess Coatlicue, was believed to have given birth to her own grandmother, because her soul reincarnated.
Well, I, of course, have always wondered, Maurice, why some people are very lucky and lead luxurious, happy lives, and other people seem to live in misery or poverty or whatever, and it there's just no sense to it. But you're saying there is a sense to it, right?
Oh, yes. It's all to do with our last life, not this life. It's what we earned in the last life that we get paid for back for in this life.
Got it. All right. Well, there you are, folks. Karma. Maurice Cotterell is my guest. This is absolutely fascinating, and we will get to the phone, so hang in there, everybody. Are you with this so far? I mean, it really is riveting stuff. Stay right there.
With Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
What do you think? Are Romeo and Juliet together in eternity? You ever wonder about that? It's in the song, right? Romeo and Juliet are together in eternity? I wonder if they are. We'll ask. We'll be right back. Is your interest level raised a little? Maurice Cotterell is my guest, and he's written three books, and so if you're interested, you can follow up. He's written The Mayan Prophecies, The Tutankhamun Prophecies, The Terracotta Warriors, The Secret Codes of the Emperor's Army, and I guess to a great degree we're talking about, prophecy and code together. In the song it said Romeo and Juliet are together in eternity. Do you think the nature of souls, or with what understanding you have of them, Maurice, I mean, people talk about soulmates, and they talk about being with their loved ones in eternity. Any basis for that being a rational belief?
Certainly. I think I take the Buddhist view that once the soul has finished its purification process, it will become one with the creative energy of the universe, which is God. It'll merge into that electromagnetic energy and lose its identity, if you like, its individuality, becoming one with God. But in the meantime, for as long as it takes, whether it's thousands or millions of years, we'll be coming back down to Earth over and over again. And there's no such thing as love at first sight. You've met the person before in a previous life. Your paths naturally cross again because it's unfinished business. And, of course, we only get 70 years at a time to sort things out. Then every few thousand years, the whole world's destroyed anyway, and we all have to start crawling around again. So, yes, I very much believe that, we meet individuals in life who give us a hard time. We meet individuals who immediately take to us and love us. And it's because of previous actions in previous lives. I don't think there's any doubt about that whatsoever. My own particular journey, just correcting the statement about the books, if I may, Art, is that there are actually five best-selling books over the last 10 years.
They only listed three for me. So what were the other two?
Yeah, that was that's published in America by American publisher, my present publisher. But in 1995, I began with the Mayan Prophecies because they worship the sun, and I decoded the treasures of the Mayans. Then I set where the knowledge came from down 2 years later in the Super Gods, which compared all the religions, 1997. That sent me on a journey to Egypt, where I studied Tutankhamun and his treasures, and that resulted in the Tutankhamun prophecies in 1999. That sent me on to Peru, where I studied the Viracochas, and that resulted in the lost tomb of Viracocha in 2001. And all of those books sent me to China, and it's my latest book, which has just been released in America, The Terracotta Warriors, The Secret Codes of the Emperor's Army, that puts the final piece in the puzzle, really. And this tells us that the first emperor of a unified China, Qin Shi Huangdi, in 220 BC, encoded the same information as all of the other sun-worshipping civilizations. His emblem was the dragon, which is a combination of the feathered snake. Again, just like Tutankhamun, just like Lord Peikal, just like the Viracochas, the same eponym, the same identity. And again, he was thought to have been born through an immaculate conception, thought to have performed miracles. When he died, he went to Venus. And the same old story as all of the other spiritual teachers. So far from being a tyrant, as historians describe him, he was actually a spiritual leader who left his super knowledge encoded into his pyramid, into his tomb, and into the 8,000 and so terracotta warriors that surround his pyramid in north-central China today.
Maurice, I interview a man from time to time whose name is Richard Hoagland. My bet is you've probably heard of him. And he has maintained, and I have not understood, but he has maintained for a long time that he believes that NASA, our space agency, actually does some things based on dates and some understanding about some things in Egypt, that the Egyptians understood something about times and planetary alignments that in some way causes NASA to act at certain times that are more favorable for one thing or another. Does that seem outrageous to you?
Not at all.
Uh-huh.
But this knowledge is not meant for everybody because it can be abused and misused.
Uh-huh.
And the Terracotta Warriors tell us that the knowledge can be abused. And just like the Bhagavad Gita and all the other texts, this is why it was spoken of in riddles. It was for the wise and those who are pursuing the middle way.
Well, Maurice, might you give us any example where or how this knowledge, the manner in which it might be abused?
Well, yes. For example, the terracotta warriors in China, in the trenches, they're in battalions. And at the vanguard of the battalions, we have unarmored archers in soft tunics with no weapons. Behind them, we have heavily armored archers kneeling down, sheltering behind the unarmored soldiers. Now, that's an irrational battle formation. You put the infantry at the front, the artillery at the front, followed by the infantry.
Right.
But they're backwards.
Right.
So there's got to be a reason for this. Nobody manufactures 8,099 life-size warriors made out of clay. It takes 10 years to bury them in a field and cover them up in tunnels for no reason at all. And what we find is once we start examining all the data and decoding the messages that they've left behind, and there are many types of messages. For example, the first one I came across in regard to the terracotta warriors was the fact that all of the soldiers had 10 face shapes. They all fell within the shapes of 10 specific characteristics. And the archaeologists had noticed that these 10 face shapes correlated with 10 characters of the Chinese, from the Chinese dictionary. And they never actually said what the words mean. Nowhere do they say, even in the tourist information. But when I got back to the UK after my trip to China, bought myself a Chinese dictionary, scoured the dictionary for these 10 Chinese characters, and I realized that they produced an expression. For example, the 10 Chinese characters, one of them was called Mu, and that in English means look at the soldiers. Another one was called Gua, which means national treasures. Another face shape was called Yang, which means in the covered corridors. Another face shape was Tian, use the mind. Feng, to see. Yor, a story about. Ri, the sun. Shen, and God. Jia, from the beginning. Ji, until now. Putting the words together, it says, look at the soldiers, the national treasures, in the covered corridors. Use the mind to see a story about the sun and God from the beginning of time until now.
Are you saying, Maurice, that a nation with this understanding could use this understanding and information to wage war and conquer?
Of course, but not in the way you're implying. For example, going back to the battle formations, what we see is that the archer carried the crossbow and aimed at the heart. And we know that the archer is the most revered soldier of all of the soldiers at Jian, because he was accurate and he was feared by the enemy. And what we find with the archer is that he is the only soldier which has a piece of his plinth missing. They're all on square plinths. What we noticed at Palenque was that the two corners of Lord Peikau's coffin lid were missing. This tells us that there's information encoded into it. It's a flag to tell us that there's more in there to be seen. So we know that the archer is very special of all the soldiers. So we've got to look at the archer in particular. And again, we say, this is the guy that carried the cross bow and aimed at the heart. Now, of course, Jesus was the guy who carried the cross and aimed at the heart. So again, we have parallels here with Christianity. So now the archer fires his arrows at somebody else, the enemy. Where does he fire at the heart? What happens when he hits the heart? The other person suffers. We're taught by Jesus that suffering purifies the heart. So if you want to get somebody to heaven, you make them suffer. Their heart suffers. They become pure. They go to heaven, which is great. They go to heaven. But how do we get to heaven? Well, the archer formation tells us if we stand in the front line with no armor and no weapons,
mm-hmm.
then we will get shot in the heart by the other side.
That's right.
They can't miss.
Oh.
So we stand up, expose our own chest, shoot us.
Yep.
We suffer, we go to heaven.
Right.
So the way to win the war is through love, not through aggression. And we say that this knowledge can be abused, and it can be. For example, I can make you hurt me so that I go to heaven. And, you know, it would be a state of chaos. Everybody going around making people hurt them.
Death by cop, for example.
Say again?
It's called death by cop. In other words, if somebody wants to, in essence, commit suicide, they walk up to a police officer and they pretend or start to draw a weapon and the policeman shoots them.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And in fact, there are arguments to say that this is exactly what Jesus did, that he wanted to purify his energy to escape the Earth's magnetic and gravitational field. So he brought about his own crucifixion. After all, this was the guy that could walk on water. This was the guy that could turn water into wine. He could easily have got down off the cross and gone for a walk, but he didn't. He endured the suffering. And through that suffering, he left his message behind about the soul and the body, about everlasting life, about heaven, and about God and so on. And the Terracotta Warriors are giving us the same message. And it's the same message as the Bhagavad Gita, because in the Bhagavad Gita, the young soldier, Arjuna, who's only 19 years old, he's the leader of the Pandavas, and he's going to start a battle with the troops of King Dhritarashtra on the other side of the valley. And he's standing there in his chariot, just like the chariots in the trenches at Xi'an, just like the chariots we mentioned earlier about the senses and the intellect and the reins and the soul. And Arjuna's standing there very despondent because he can see in the trenches across the valley his teachers and his relatives who he doesn't want to kill. But he's a soldier. He's the leader of his troops. He's got to go through with it. And he looks heavenwards and he says to God, "What am I doing here? Mm-hmm. What's it all about?" And at that moment, Krishna comes down and sits next to Arjuna in his moment of need on his chariot. And it's as though time stops. And Krishna explains to Arjuna the difference between the body and the soul. He explains to him about his duty, that in this life it's ordained that he's a soldier. If he wins the battle, he'll be a king on earth. If he loses, he'll be a king in heaven, because all he has to do is perform his duty. Hmm. And the Bhagavad Gita teaches the difference between right and wrong.
Why do you think, Maurice, that Christianity teaches and always has taught that the kind of thing we're talking about right now would be regarded as a mortal sin?
I don't think it does. It's just that it's very complex. And, you know, Jesus didn't have a three-hour radio show to try to put his views across. So he simplified the message, and he said, love your neighbor. Look after the pennies, and the pounds look after themselves, if you like, or look after the cents, and the dollars look after themselves.
Yes.
Because, you know, at the end of the day, we can go through all this super science of the sun, cosmic cycles, x-rays, genetic mutations. We can go through spirituality, the soul, E equals MC squared. At the end of the day, we get back to, if you love each other, you'll go to heaven.
Yes. Yes, but the manner of death that we described a little while ago, and the soldiers that you described in China, that would seem to almost be into the category of suicidal, and suicide is regarded as a mortal sin in the Christian world.
No, there's a difference. It's a question of intent. There's no such thing as suicide. If you kill your body, it will simply reincarnate, and your soul will simply reincarnate into another body. There's no question about this. There is no escape from hell. It's not that easy. Uh-huh. The only escape from hell is through purification of the spirit. It's the only way. So suicide, it really is irrelevant. Now, if you say you go up to a cop, you assault the cop shoots you, it's still suicide because it was a chain of events. You know, the Bhagavad Gita tells us about action and reaction.
Well, it's an intent, right? If your intent was to cause him to shoot you, then you have, as we understand it in the modern world, you've committed suicide.
Legally you have. Technically you have.
Right.
But your soul will be will attach itself to a fetus in a passing womb within seconds. It'll be reborn again, so you're not actually dead. Only the body has died. And that's the difference. We're talking about biological suicide, not spiritual suicide.
The whole process of reincarnation has always seemed, and maybe you can explain it, but it's always seemed so tragically unfair to me, since there is no continuity of consciousness or remembrance of acts for which you are now paying, and you are paying with karma, all through a life, and you have no remembrance whatsoever of why you're paying this price. It doesn't seem fair, Maurice.
Oh, it's absolutely fair. If you were aware of it, then you'd adjust your behavior accordingly. But it's self-regulating. As I hit upon earlier, the soul, the existence of the soul is like in an elevator. If it's born a rich man, it's rich in one life. It has servants. and you live a rich lifestyle.
Yes.
You get fat, you get unhealthy, you push your servants about, you push people around, and what happens is you generate karma and your soul voltage goes down.
Yep.
So in the next life, the elevator goes down to the ground floor, if you like.
And you're sleeping on a grate.
You come down back as a poor person.
Yep.
People kick you around.
Yep.
And you start questioning, hey, why are you kicking me around? As you said, what's all this karma about? What have I done to you? I've never even met you before.
Yes.
And your soul voltage starts to go up because you wouldn't kick somebody because you know how much it hurts. So in the next life, you come back rich again. And it's like this elevator going up and up and down, up and down, up and down. And we can never get to the 100th floor to get to heaven. And if we were given the answers, it would be far too easy to get to heaven. And it's very, very difficult to get to heaven. And this is why all this stuff's encoded, as we said earlier. It's only for those on the middle way who are spiritual. And as the philosopher, the Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu once commented, on hearing of the way to heaven, the middle way, the best of men explore its length. Mediocre men pick it up and put it down. And fools, when they hear of the way, they laugh out loud.
Mm.
And if they didn't laugh, it wouldn't be the way. Now, this is what the main reason why it's secret. We can't have bad people getting to heaven. And this is why there is no memory from life to life. Maya is an ancient Sanskrit word which means illusion. Everything we see is illusion. We think our children belong to us when they're total strangers, for example. We think we have some power over others if we're rich, when in fact we do not even have power over ourselves. He who masters himself is master of himself and master of the world.
So if we had knowledge, Maurice, from one life to the other, then the trip to heaven would be too easy.
It would be too easy. But those who are on the spiritual path are inherently aware that there is something else. We carry from one life to another sanskaras, tiny bits of information. And this is why some children are born as prodigies, like Mozart.
Yes.
They come back from the last life and they can immediately play a piano at the age of 5 and things like that. Now, sanskaras, although the soul is still electromagnetic energy, it carries a modulation, if you like, from the last life. And it's a bit like, I try to use the analogy of a loaf of bread. A loaf of bread tastes the same because it's got the same ingredients, whether it's a round loaf or a flat loaf or a square loaf. But it can carry information. If it's a round loaf, we could say it resembles the letter O. If it's a long loaf, we could say it represents the letter I. So information is contained, can be contained on the soul as the same way as it can on a loaf. It's like having a ping pong ball or a golf ball or a ball with spikes on it. It's the same energy, but it's been shaped so characteristically by its previous incarnation, or it died so tragically in the previous incarnation, that it takes that energy with it into the next. And we know there's something more. People listening to your show, these are the exceptional people. They're looking for answers. They've got questions. They're interested in life. They're interested in what life's all about. They know there must be more. They've all been here before. There are millions out there not listening to this broadcast. They're not interested. They're young, low-voltage souls. They can't relate to it. They think everybody else is crazy because they can't see what's in front of their eyes.
All right, Maurice, hold it right there. We're at the top of the hour. We're going to go to the phone shortly, and the high-voltage souls will stick with us. I'm Art Bell.
Blade. The bastards hung me in the street. ring of 25, but I am still alive.
I was a sailor, I was born upon the tide. With the sea I did abide. I sailed a schooner around the Horn of Mexico. I went aloft to furl the mainsail in a blow. And when the yards broke off, they said that I got killed. But I'm living still. I was a dam builder across a river deep and wide, where steel and water did collide. A place called Boulder on the Wild Colorado. I slipped and fell into the wet concrete below. They buried me in that gray tomb that knows no sound. But I'm still around. I'll always be around.
Want to take a ride? To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
So we don't think about these things, huh? Yes, we do. Maurice Cotterell is my guest, and boy, the things we are speaking of this night. If you have questions, those were the numbers, and we're just about to rock. Stay right where you are. Well, all right, we're about to go to the phone lines with Maurice Cotterell, and I here's something that I want you all to think about, all right? We're having this conversation with Maurice all the way from West Cork, Ireland. He's in Ireland right now, so he's a long way away, and there is an effect. It's called, in the old days you'd have called it the Bell System effect. That means we're utilizing a satellite or whatever means we are to get to Ireland. So there's a brief interval between when you say something and when the other person hears it. And for broadcast purposes, that means it's very confusing and people tend to interrupt each other. So as I allow you to ask a question tonight and come to you on the line, it's best if you formulate your question or what you're going to say, and then just stop, pause, and wait for an answer, and not try to be too interactive, because that delay will really screw you up. I'm telling you, it'll really mess you up. And so kind of have what you want to say all ready to say. And remember, there is that time difference. There certainly is. Maurice, welcome back. We are about to go to the phones. I do have a message from Aaron Carr, Madison, Wisconsin, who says, "Hey there, Art. Good to hear you on the air. I have a question about the 28-day solar radiation cycle that Maurice just mentioned." This is going back a little. He said, within each 28-day cycle are four periods that are positive, negative, positive, negative. Is that a sine wave pattern?
It is, in answer to the question, it is a sine wave pattern, but one of those quarter sine waves, if you like, of the four, a quarter of the cycle is burned out every month due to the differential rotation of the sun's polar caps. And basically what that means is if we have the sine wave of 1, 2, 3, 4, the four quadrants, positive, negative, positive, negative, mm-hmm. then if you imagine the sequence of radiation on the first month is 1, 2, 3, the second month it's 1, 2, 4, the third month is 1, 3, 4, and the fourth month is 2, 3, 4. So a different sector is burned out by the North Polar activity on the sun's surface. That gives us four separate types of radiation, and that creates the four elemental signs of fire, earth, air, and water when those genes are mutated by the radiation patterns. Then, of course, the sequence repeats over and over again because the sun is spinning.
You've mentioned a number of times, Maurice, that you used one of the world's best computers to come to these conclusions mathematically. You needed that kind of computational power. What computer did you use, and how did you get time on it?
Well, at the time, I was working at Cranfield University, and I was head of electrical and communications engineering for the campus site services. And one of my areas of responsibility was a computer center at Cranfield Computer Center. And I had this problem of trying to calculate the sunspot cycle. I tried to do it longhand, and I guess it would have been possible if I'd had about 1,000 years, but it had taken me about 8 months just to do three or four tiny little pieces because I had to do several calculations over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a chat with one of the programmers down there, and we put together an algorithm for and we pumped in the solar variables of 26 days for the solar equator, 37 days for the pole, and of course if you're on the Earth, it's 28 days and 40 days because the Earth's moving. Then we pumped in the Earth's 365.25-day period, and we asked the computer to work out the differences between these magnetic fields forever and ever. And we had this huge graph came out about a week later, which was all over the floor, literally. It was that long. And I had to examine the graph to try to figure out what was going on and where the cycles began and where one cycle ended and so on. Without that, I could never have come up with the figure of 1366560 for the magnetic flip of the neutral sheet. I would never have invested the Mayan civilization, and I would never have investigated the civilizations that followed. So everything came from cracking the sunspot cycle code, and it was fascinating and exhilarating when I did it.
I'll bet it was. Was this computer time authorized, or were you just sort of using the otherwise idle time of the computer and the programmer? How did that work?
It was informal. It was idle time.
I see.
And it was private research.
I've got you. Okay, fascinating. I would like to begin to take some questions, if you wouldn't mind. I mean, what you've said obviously is just going to boggle a lot of people's minds as it sinks in. You know, the complexity and at the same time the simpleness of what you're saying. And it is both complex and simple, isn't it?
It is, absolutely.
Uh-huh. So let's see what people ask about it. I'm very curious. First time caller line, you're on the air with Maurice Cotterell. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
How are you tonight?
Quite well, sir.
My question to your guest tonight is there anything, any kind of information that he may have that, according to his Mayan calendar, as far as the return of Jesus Christ to the earth?
All right. But not a bad question, actually. You talked about the various teachers that have come for various cycles and civilizations. Maurice, what about that? Any indication of the return of Christ?
Looking at the pictures from the Mayan civilization, from the amazing lid of Palenque, the lid that covered his tomb, from the mosaic mask, the mask that covered Lord Paykal's face, from the mural of Bon Impac, the paintings on the wall in the jungle at Bon Impac, the pictures tell us that Jesus Christ did reincarnate as the Viracochas in AD 100 and AD 300, also as Lord Paykal in AD 750. So this reincarnation process or revisitation of the Christ-like spirit is continuous. There is no, as far as I know, unless I've missed it, I mean, if we look at the pictures with a different eye, people will see them perhaps slightly differently and see something which I've missed. But we're not at the end of the study yet. One of the pictures, or a sequence of pictures from the mosaic mask of Palenque, shows that there is another chamber in the Temple of Inscriptions. It tells us how to access the chamber. It tells us how to open the door to the chamber, and it tells us that once we've opened the door, we will see Lord Paykal again.
Mm-hmm.
So the instructions are there, and in answer to the question, I'm sure the answer is there, but I can't get to the pyramid. They won't let me in. Nobody will believe that the pictures exist because nobody will believe that the Mayas were this intelligent. Archaeologists imagine that because they didn't have transparencies, that they were stupid. but they didn't need transparencies because we now know it was Lord Pakal who was a miracle maker. And, of course, there are other ways of looking at this Maya transformer, I call them, whereby we take an image, take a photocopy of the image, the mirror image, put one on top of the other, and we can see these encoded pictures. Now, I'm quite sure that, I mean, you can see them for your own eyes on the website. So, and also in the books, they're detailed, they're frozen in the books in photographs and pictures, so you can study them to your heart's content. There's no trickery or anything else involved. It's very, I hope, scholarly, scientific, and the Terracotta Warriors sets down all of the information from all of the previous books in the appendices.
Maurice, would you say that your understanding of this to date, and you admit you have more research to do, but would you say that your understanding of this has become, for you, a religion?
Not a religion. In fact, the opposite. It's usurped religion. It's wiped religion away. Because what it shows me is that all of the religious leaders were the same guy, keep coming back. Therefore, all of the religions are the same, and therefore there should be no distinction between religion as such. We're all mankind. And it's like Akhenaten going back to monotheism, worshipping one God, and realizing that everybody has God within them. It's time to, perhaps to get rid of religion now, once we've reached that level of understanding, because there's no point in squabbling about, it's like moving deck chairs around the Titanic. You know, people squabbling over nothing.
Okay. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Maurice Cotterell. Hello.
Hello.
Hi. I can barely hear you, hon. You're going to have to yell at me, so go ahead.
Hi, Art and Maurice. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
It's been such a long time since I've heard anyone speak about King Tut. In the late 70s, I had a vision of King Tut when I was a teenager. And I've never spoken to it about to anyone. And when I heard you speak about it, I had chills. And to the point of almost crying, that King Tut has been reborn. And what you speak of is the correct truth. It's enlightening.
Yeah,
when you think about this.
To listen to this is jarring, actually, in a lot of ways. Quite jarring. Maurice, I use the word religion very loosely here, but when I said, hasn't it become a religion for you, how could you understand all you have explained to us, believe it to be true, and not have it, allow me the loose use of the word religion, as your new religion, as your new entire belief system?
Well, it could alienate some listeners because, you know, some people think we've got enough religions already. And in fact, what I'm actually doing is going back in time to the time of Moses and, as I say, Akhenaten, rather than having another branch of the same theistic tree.
Yes, but it does amount to a full belief system.
Oh, it certainly is a full belief system. And just going back to the caller, it does bring tears to your eyes. When I decoded the picture of Lord Pakal on the tomb lid at Palenque, after working for 12 months, 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, I came out with the first picture of the man in the tomb himself. That brought tears to my eyes. And I'm telling you, I felt completely insignificant in the universe when I realized the intelligence that lay before me.
Sure.
So once you grasp this knowledge, you are overwhelmed. Not frightened, certainly not frightened. Some people are frightened, they turn and walk away. Some people burst into tears when I give my lectures and show them the pictures.
And Marie, some people would get very angry.
Some people get very angry indeed because they're not ready for the knowledge.
Well, or it conflicts with very specific knowledge they have and their entire belief system.
Absolutely.
So, this knowledge, if commonly embraced, certainly would change the world in almost every way, but it would conflict with so much and so many belief systems. My goodness.
Yes, it would, but it would change the world. It would simplify things, and there would be no religious wars, no more conflict, and of course it would no longer be hell. So we can't have that. So this belief system will never be embraced by everybody. It'll only be embraced by a few at a time.
You're right.
In that way, God created a perfect universe good souls will go back to God. God will grow forever and ever and ever. Mm-hmm. If we all went to heaven, God would grow once, but then would stop growing.
Well, perhaps then you can help us with this. It's always been a question that has bugged people about reincarnation. There are now 6 billion plus souls on the earth. The number keeps growing and growing. And many would say, well, where are the souls all coming from? There appear to be excess souls. Are you suggesting that souls are, many of them, even alien, or is it man, earth man, returning to earth woman?
It's neither, actually. What we have to imagine is that the first beings, the shining ones they were referred to in several texts, were actually light beings of about 3 billion volts each. But now we've got 6 billion people who are only 1 volt each, because the voltage of the soul has degenerated over the last 5,000 years. So it's the same voltage, the same spiritual energy on Earth, but each individual, this is why we're all fighting each other, because the soul is like a driver of the chariot or the driver of the automobile. And what's happened is the cars are driving themselves around now with no drivers, because the voltage of the driver's got so low, the spirituality's got so low, that people don't see themselves as souls anymore. They see themselves as biological beings, producing biological beings. But there are other mechanisms in the soul world.
So they are unguided souls, then?
They are. But there are, you know, all we've spoken of today basically is the physical world, although we have touched on the soul world and what soul energy is. But the physical world teaches us about the soul world. For example, if we can have a nervous breakdown in the physical world, the soul can have a soul breakdown in the soul world. Mm. And as I say, all of these things are sent to teachers. Now, what happens then if a soul suffers soul breakdown? And this is my understanding of the soul from the ancient texts and the ancient pictures. If a soul has a breakdown, it's like throwing a rock through a car windscreen. Instead of being one windscreen, we get 500 little windscreens. And instead of having a 10-volt single soul, we have 500 millivolt souls, but 500 of them, for example. And when those 500 little souls reincarnate, they come back as a shoal of fish, for example. And this is why when you observe a shoal of fish, if the shoal moves to the left, they all move to the left immediately.
Right.
It's the same soul. If they move to the right, they all move to the right immediately. They're all in communication with each other.
That's great. I never in a million years thought of it that in that way, but you really believe that is literally true?
Absolutely. And this is why bundles of midges or mosquitoes fly in circles or spheres.
Oh, yes.
It's the same soul energy. And the Hindus believe that if the voltage gets lower and lower, then we come back as animals and so on and go through down the food chain.
Uh-huh.
And the Mayans believe that we lived in the underworld, which is where the scorpions live and the snakes and the beetles. And it does seem that we can come back if the soul degenerates to such a nano-voltage technology that we can actually come back as insects. And that is hell on earth. This is the place of hell. This is hell. It's just that we have a different consciousness depending on our previous lives, on our previously earned karma.
Huh. Such knowledge. What was your belief system, Maurice, when you stumbled into this?
I've always been drawn towards Christianity from an early age, and there's no reason for that because the family was not Christian. I grew up in, not devoutly Christian, they're just loosely Christian because I came from a Christian state, England. But I was always drawn to Christianity. And I remember once, in fact, when I first came to Ireland at the age of 8 with a school on a school visit, our parents had all given us a couple of dollars to spend on sweets and candy and so on. And I rushed out and I went down the pier in Bray in Ireland, near Dublin, and I bought 20... religious plates, small plates, about 4 inches square, ceramic plates, and it had Jesus on them, God bless this house.
Mm-hmm.
Another one had, suffer the little children, come unto me. Mm-hmm. I had pictures of Jesus, and I took them back to the hotel where we were staying, and the teacher said to me, Maurice, are you Catholic? And I said, no, miss. She said, why have you bought all these? I said, I don't know, I just like them. Now, clearly, there was a samskara there, which is familiar with the Christos, the Christ teaching. And it's been there from an early age. And as I went through life, it became stronger and stronger, the pull. And I started, it was through the engineering and the science I became interested in all of this.
I mean, fascinating, the route, the path, the road you're on. Maurice is fascinating. I wonder what your last life was like. It must have been a total wreck. Maurice, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. Maurice Cotterell is my guest. We'll be right back.
Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from East of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From West of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Well, good morning. It is a fascinating morning, isn't it? Maurice Cotterell is my guest, and he'll be right back. All right, a very obvious next step for those of you who want to pursue more information on tonight would be the website. Right, Maurice?
Yes, that's correct.
And we, of course, have a link there tonight, but for those who wish to write it down for future reference, it is mauricecotterell.com, is it not?
That's correct.
Are you able to take many hits at one time?
Well, usually when I do the coast-to-coast, it crashes, but just keep on trying and you'll get through.
Yes, it will arise again. Maurice, speaking of that, I've got Gary in Sacramento who would like to know if perhaps there might be a teacher-level consciousness, a Christ-Buddha-type teacher on Earth right now.
I just don't know the answer to that one, I'm afraid, Art. It's possible. Anything's possible. But I just don't have that information at the moment. But as I say, if other people examine the pictures, I mean, I've decoded them, and I've put my own interpretation to them. But if other people wish to examine the pictures, and many of them are in the Terracotta Warriors, then you may find information which does lead us to suspect that there is somebody at this time walking the earth who is a Christ-like figure.
What will be the course of your research from this point, Maurice?
Well, one book has led on to the next, and there's only one sun-worshipping civilization I've yet to look at, and that's the sun-worshipping civilization of the Celtic people. So I've already started the next book, The Celtic Chronicles, provisionally entitled, although it will probably be called something else in due course. And what I've discovered is clearly if the Celts understood the super science of the sun, which they clearly did because the Celtic cross resembles a magnetic schematic of the sun, the circle with a cross in it, then clearly there must have been a super god, a spiritual teacher who lived among them. And when I started to inquire into the Celts 2 years ago, I did find the Celtic god. His name was Cernunnos. And he led me on to the Excalibur, the sword of King Arthur.
Mm-hmm.
And by pulling Excalibur from the stone, as it were, I was able to locate the Holy Grail. And decoding the Holy Grail, the cup used by Jesus at the crucifixion and, of course, at the Last Supper, I was able to determine that Jesus actually encoded the super science of the sun into the Holy Grail, just in keeping with all of the other sun-worshipping super gods. And, of course, to this point, Jesus was the odd one out, because although we know he taught us how to get to heaven, we had no idea that Jesus embraced or understood the super science of the sun like the other super gods. But the Holy Grail, which is in a museum in Ireland, but people don't know it, the Holy Grail actually explains everything we've been talking about tonight.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Maurice Carrell. Hello.
Hi, Art and Maurice.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Where are you, sir?
I'm Doran from Hyattsville, Maryland.
Maryland, okay.
Yes. Quick question about reincarnation. My script is the exact same as my uncle, who died 4 years before I was born.
Your script?
My writing.
Oh, I see. Yes.
And even my family cannot decipher between the two. What do you think about that?
When did he die?
He died in 54. I was born in 58.
You could well be the reincarnation. This often happens. I've only ever witnessed one reincarnation.
Oh.
And generally speaking, you can't witness them until you're ready to, until your soul is pure enough to understand what's going on. But it does seem that souls come back to the same DNA, as I said earlier. And this means that if you don't have children, of course, if you live a life of celibacy, then it makes it very difficult to come back again. So you seem to have two choices. If you can't go to hell, there's only two places left, so the Mayas tell us. That's heaven or purgatory. So the fact that monks are celibate helps the soul get to heaven. But an interesting sideline there. I had a friend who's a vicar. I still do. He's 70 years old now. He's retired. And when I traveled to Peru a few years back, he looked after the house in England for me. And on my return, we were having a bottle of wine and dinner. And I said, well, I'm tired. You know, when death comes, I'll be quite happy about it. Mm. And I said, basically, I'm worn out. And he said, oh, I've had a wonderful life. I'd like to live my life all over again. And I said, well, of course, you would. You're a vicar. Everybody loves a vicar. And it made me realize that vicars can't go to heaven, because the only people who can go to heaven are those who suffer. And because everybody loves a vicar, vicars and priests and monks don't suffer. So what happens is they come back as masochists, very clever people who ask a lot of questions and upset everybody around them. So it seems to me that I must have been a monk in my last life. In this life, I'm a masochist. I provoke the scientists. I provoke the engineers. I provoke the biologists. I provoke the behavioral theorists. I keep on pressing them for questions, information, and they keep hurting me.
Oh, yes.
My soul purifies quickly, and I'm on the fast track to heaven, if you like.
Well, there's probably going to be plenty of suffering if you keep it up. All right, hold on. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Maurice Cotterell. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Art.
Yes.
Good show. Good to hear you back.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would just like to ask your guest, with reincarnation, how do you know how many souls exist? A couple of questions if I got a follow-up, too.
I didn't get, what was the first question?
How many souls, how do you know how many souls exist?
Is there an unlimited,
million souls?
Yes, is there an unlimited number of souls, Maurice?
Well, of course, because you can divide anything as many times as you like. And we're talking about electromagnetic energy. If you imagine a bubble of voltage energy, you can keep on chopping it in half with a knife forever and ever.
Yeah,
but the pieces get smaller and smaller.
Yeah, but can I ask a follow-up, Art?
Go on, follow.
Yeah.
Yeah, go on.
The idea is that God doesn't make mistakes unless you suggest that God isn't perfect.
God does not make mistakes, I agree.
He eternally creates spirits, right?
Yes, yes.
And so how could anybody suppose to know the number, which they can't? And if he suggests that he sent somebody here to do what he would have them do, which is the best they could do, that he would make mistakes to have to bring them back. And
it
would suggest that.
We have free will, don't forget.
Yeah.
So we have...
You know, for example, is spirits looking down on their ancestors, their predecessors, and this is where the idea and the notion of reincarnation comes from, because they've seen them in action, and they understand the lines through which they're coming.
Well, some people believe that the past is the future and the future is the past, and that we've all been through this before. And the ones who escape don't go through it again, but for everybody else, you know, there are some schools of thought. For example, the Brahma Kumaris, an Indian group of the Krishna school, who believe that the same fly will fly past you in your room in 5,000 years' time.
Right.
In other words, we keep going round and round, but there's a leakage from the system as the souls purify and go to heaven. And the other, so when we go to a clairvoyant, she's not actually looking towards the future. She's looking at the past, if you like, to see what's gone before, and in that way knows what's going to happen again in the future.
Makes sense. International Line, you're on the air with Maurice Cotterell. Hello.
Oh, yes. Hi, Art and Maurice. Thank you for taking my call. My name's Jeff, and I'm calling from Winnipeg, Canada.
Okay, Jeff.
Yeah, I have a question about Venus, and its soon passage in front of the sun. I've been doing a little bit of research on the Internet, and I found that the last time it happened was in 1874 and 1882, and it happens in pairs.
There's a lot of people talking about this, actually.
Yeah. June 8th, 2004, which is Tuesday, is the day that this is supposed to happen. And then again, June 6th, 2012, which is very close to that Mayan calendar end date. There's people talking about it as being the final transformation of the human mind into a mind of light, or the enlightenment of humanity. I was just wondering if that jives with Maurice, and it being Venus being the feminine aspect and related to the principle of oneness, how that might also interact with the physical activities of the Earth.
Okay, could 2012 be the big one?
Very interesting questions, Jeff. Yes, it's a big day on Tuesday. One of the transits of Venus will occur, and it's only an event which happens every 120 years because of the geometry of the Earth and Venus going around the Sun. And there will, as you're quite right, be another one in 2012, but then there will not be another one again for 120 years or thereabouts.
Well, let's ask about Tuesday, since it's so close.
Tuesdays, it begins at, I think it's 17 minutes past 6 in the UK in the morning, 06:17 British Standard Time, which will be... I guess 05 GMT.
What's the likely meaning of this?
Well,
I mean, when this occurs, what?
Yes, I mean, we're asked the meaning in the context of 2012 and Maya belief. And there have been several commentators suggested that there will be a change in consciousness, a change in emotional behavior, and so on. But we have to keep our feet firmly on the ground. There's no evidence to suggest that any of this is going to occur. The only reference to 2012 is in the Maya calendar, and the only reference to the end of that calendrical date is in the books of Chile and Balaam. And it's quite clear, it says, at that time, kings will be without children, and there will be no bread. There will be a famine. It doesn't say anything about shifting consciousness or anything else. Now, we can give somebody an inch, and they might take a yard, but, there's no evidence for that. Now, what I said in the Mayan prophecies back in 95 was that the Maya were more intelligent than we are today. They forecasted their own demise in the year 750 AD from a magnetic reversal and a reduced fertility, increased bombardment by X-rays, a mini ice age, and so on. And what they're saying now, it seems to be that there's going to be another magnetic reversal in 2012 from the books of Chile and Balam, because it's talking about fertility minimum and drought again. Now, they're saying that. I'm saying, yes, we should believe them because they're more intelligent than we are. But I have found no evidence for anything that's going to happen in 2012. But that doesn't mean I'm right. It means perhaps my research is not exhaustive, and I've still yet something to discover.
Well, how about Tuesday?
Tuesday, there's nothing in the Mayan calendar that says that the second before the last Venus transit will cause any major occurrence on Earth. Mm-hmm. There's no reason for that. What will happen is, as Venus passes between the Sun and the Earth, is that the beam of cosmic particles, the solar wind, will be modulated. A ripple will go from one side of the Sun to the other during the 7 hours it takes for Venus to pass in front of the Sun.
The effect of which will be what?
Well, we'll get a magnetic whiplash on the Earth's magnetosphere. There'll be a 7-hour ripple, if you like, in the Earth's magnetosphere as Venus moves across the Sun, and that may affect the performance of the brain. It may affect how we feel. Clearly, astrologically, the astrologers are the best people to ask for a conjunction, a planetary conjunction, and what the effects that might have on living beings on Earth. But
and on souls that might be incarnating during that period.
It will certainly have an effect on souls which are attaching to bodies and to bodies which are attracting down souls at that time. No question about that. It will cause genetic mutations, a degree of variance. So all those born on Tuesday will be Gemini, but they'll have a variation which only occurs once every 120 years, and that is through, as the cells divide, if a sperm is entering an ovum on the 2nd of June and the cells are beginning the process of mitosis, the cell division, from 4 to 16 and so on, then at that moment, if Venus passes in front of the Sun, upsets the beam of cosmic particles, the solar wind, which actually takes 3 days to reach Earth, so it's going to be 3 days later, it'll be the 9th of June where the effect will be seen on Earth rather than the 6th, because the particles take longer than the actual light waves. But yes, it will have an effect on the genetic mutations. That will have an effect on the personality. And whether or not that will be measurable is a different kettle of fish.
Well, I'm a Gemini, and I can tell you for sure that a genetically mutated Gemini would be a fearsome thing to deal with. So there you are. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Maurice Carrel. Hello. Hello?
Yep.
Yes?
Is it me?
Yeah, it's you. You're going to have to speak up good and loud at me.
Okay. I'm Linda, calling from Miami, WIOD.
Yes, ma'am.
And may I please borrow your guest for a moment?
That's the idea. Go ahead.
Okay. This is, like, unbelievable. My great-grandmother, my grandfather, my father, and my father-in-law were all born on the 21st of December. I know this is child's play to him, but and then that was all four of them on the 21st of December.
Ma'am, we're almost out of time.
Okay.
What were you suggesting by this?
My childhood love. My first husband was December 24th. My childhood love and soulmate was the 25th. And my husband
and ma'am, excuse me, we've got to cut to the... Ma'am, please, what are you suggesting by all these...
What are the odds of that? I mean, I know they're astronomical.
Yes, I'm sure they are. And there are coincidences in the world. Not everything is connected in the way she imagines. Go ahead, Maurice.
I would say it's more than coincidence. People are attracted to the star signs which they get along with. So it's not surprising that we tend to be attracted to the same partners throughout our lives.
Right.
Of a particular pattern. And it does seem to follow very often that parents and children are born at the same times, and that seems to be genetic. And maybe it's the karma saying that we didn't learn much in the last life.
There's no question about it, Maurice. We always go after the same type. Men go after the same kind of women. Women go after the same kind of men. Again.
Exactly.
And again and again.
That's right.
West of the Rockies, very quickly, you're on the air with Maurice Cotterell. Hello.
Yeah, real quick question. What is the name of the museum that the Holy Grail is being kept in?
It's the museum in Dublin, but that's all I'm going to tell you.
Well, thank you very much.
It's the Celtic collection in Dublin.
Well, it's a pretty big piece of information if you're looking. All right.
Hey, thank you very much, guys.
All right, thank you. All right, Maurice, we're about out of time here. You know, where in your collection of work so far that you've written should people begin? Where's the right place to begin right now?
I think the most recent release in the United States, the Terracotta Warriors, which has only been on the market now a few weeks, it contains all of the previous books condensed in the appendices. So by reading that one, they'll be able to catch up on all of the others. Clearly, if they want to learn more about Tutankhamun, they need to look at the Tutankhamun prophecies. If they want more on the Viracochas of Peru and the lost tomb of Viracocha. But by reading the Terracotta Warriors, they'll be able to find a way forward as to which where their interests lie. But the Terracotta Warriors covers everything we've spoken about tonight, the secret codes of the Emperor's Army. And it's by Bear & Company. It's a lovely, beautifully presented, beautifully published hardback, one to keep for the future.
Are you available to be chatted with on email? Is your email address up there somewhere?
It's on the website, and it's sunspotuk@aol.com. sunspotuk@aol.com. That's on the website. Have a look at the website. It's very interesting, very easy to follow. It's also got the animations from Mexico on there, which are absolutely fascinating. And have fun.
Well, you too, and thank you so very much for being here, Maurice.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Good night. And, well, what an interview that was, huh? Wow. That was really something, as will be tomorrow night. And again, we note, of course, the very sad passing of Ronald Reagan yesterday at 1 o'clock. From the high desert in the middle of the night, in the middle of the weekend, I'm Art Bell. Y'all have a good night.